This is the show your pastor warned you about.
I welcome my friends to Stand to Reason. So glad you're with me today here. Looking forward to 3 hours of talking with you about the things that really matter, of course. I have been thinking about a lot of things this last week or so that I want to get to, chat with you about. Have had a lot of interviews the last few weeks, so that has preempted some of these remarks. But I plan to do that today, and you can engage me, if you like, in conversation. The number is 1-800-227-5278. This is Stand to Reason, where we talk about the things that are most important in life, and especially with a mind to demonstrating that Christianity, that is classical Christianity, and the values that seem to follow properly or logically from the Christian worldview, where those both of those things are defended here in the public square of talk radio. And so you can call me at 1-800-227-5278 and engage me broadly on any of those issues. The 714 area code number is 754-4150. So the lines are open and people are already getting in the queue, so I'd be glad to chat with you. I have been buoyed in the last few weeks, especially, though I would say in the last couple months this has been building up, buoyed in my confidence in the truthfulness of the Christian worldview. Now, in a way, that might sound a little strange to some of you, because you might be thinking, well, if he's buoyed in his confidence, that means his confidence has increased. That means that it was less than it is now. And how can that be? He's an apologist, for goodness sake. He's the one who reads all the books and knows all the smart guys and has all the answers, or so some think. Well, first of all, I don't have all the answers. And in fact, the more that I learn, like many of the smart guys, the more we realize what we don't know. Others, and not just the so-called smart guys, but the rank and file follower of Christ, and actually it's not just the rank and file follower of Christ, but it's the rank and file human being, there is kind of an ebb and flow of confidence that we have in the things that we believe. And even when your beliefs are carefully reflected upon, that you're living what Socrates called the examined life, when you are loving God with your whole heart, mind, soul, and strength, as Jesus said, even so, the confidence that we have that what we hold is true fluctuates because we're human beings. And it's not unusual to think, well, what about those things I don't know? Is there anything in what I don't know that would make a difference in what I think I do know? What about that person who's completely convinced that I'm wrong in almost everything that I believe? And that person has just as much confidence as in his denial of my convictions as I have in my affirmation of my convictions. And incidentally, just as an aside, I've had people point that out to me before, people who disagreed with me, and say, well, there are people that have that are just as convinced of their view as you are of yours, as if this matters in the discussion. Yes, there are people like that. But since conviction or strength of conviction doesn't create the truth, then it does no good to look at other people who have just as strong as of convictions as I do. It only matters the reasons they hold their convictions, and you can't tell that from looking at their zeal or strength of conviction. So this is not a helpful observation, but it is often used to dismiss me and my views as being just as good as the other person's just because they have just the same level of conviction. But it is part of the human condition to wonder and to doubt and to go up and down. And I have had my share of doubts over my Christian life. Obviously, nothing debilitating, or I wouldn't be sitting here. And in fact, it's the process of engaging, embracing my doubts, engaging the challenge of my doubts that has helped me to resolve the challenges that I have. In fact, I heard Dr. Paul Meyer who many of you know because he's been on this show before, and he's written a number of books about early Christianity, and he's a professor in history, actually a professor of ancient history, but he likes to say he's an ancient professor of history because he's getting up there in years at Western Michigan University. He even said yesterday that he's gone through his times of doubts, and those have helped him. I'm not particularly in a time of doubt myself, but I would say that in the last few weeks, my convictions have even been further buoyed by the interaction that I've had with careful thinkers and the reflections that I've had on not only the writings of those careful thinkers, but in defense of Christianity and in support of the Christian worldview, but in also by thinking of and reflecting on the nature of the challenges against our view. And so I've done a bit of work with the New Atheists in the last couple of years. I've listened to some debates, or a debate actually recently with Christopher Hitchens and Bill Craig. I've seen the things that they've written. I've listened to their responses to things, and they just strike me as so poor. I wonder why they can't do better. And when I reflect on the evidence now coming out almost daily for the profound design in the universe. A point that I mentioned to an audience in Indianapolis yesterday that can no longer be denied. I mean, the Richard Dawkinses of the universe of the world can say, yes, it looks like design, but it's not. Well, I think increasingly it's becoming clear that the universe, not just the biological realm, which is what Dawkins deals with, but the universe itself, the cosmos, including our solar system, looks designed because probably it was designed. Reading through Anthony Flew's book, There Is a God, subtitle How the World's Most Notorious Atheist Changed His Mind, had Gary Habermas on a couple of weeks ago, and we talked about his relationship with Anthony Flew. Gary Habermas, the Christian writer and thinker on the resurrection and near-death experiences in the Shroud of Turin. Actually, he's an expert in that as well. We had dinner two nights ago, on the East Coast. Gary and I and a couple of the others from the CIA Christian, Christian Cross-Examined Instructors Academy. There you go. Working with Frank Turek there, and when you read the book by Flew, There Is a God, and the reasons why he changed his mind, why he spent most of his life, he's in his 80s now, as not only an atheist but as a champion of atheism. In fact, he wrote the book The Presumption of Atheism. He was part of the Socratic Club, I think was the name of it, that C.S. Lewis himself was the chairman of back in the early 50s. I mean, he goes back that far. He's part of that crowd. He's been an atheist all that time. Yet the evidence of design in the universe was so powerful that he changed his mind. Now, some have said, yeah, he's 80. He's getting a little daft. He's getting, senile, until you read his book. Notice, by the way, that kind of challenge qualifies for what I call trash talk, where you are confronted with a challenge to your ideas, and instead of dealing with the merits of the challenge proper, you distract attention onto something else. Oh, Flew's just going a little bit nutty in his old age. Well, would you care to address Flew's arguments before you accuse him of having Alzheimer's or something? Because what matters is not how old he is. What matters is whether his arguments are good. And reading through this book, and it's an easy read, and he's quite lucid. And he even has an appendix at the end where N.T. Wright argues why he thinks the resurrection happened. And Flew, who is not a Christian theist, says that this is the most compelling argument he's ever heard for the resurrection. So you owe it to yourself, if you'd like to, read Anthony Flew's book, There Is a God. And as I read those things, I think, golly gee, and especially by contrast with the foolishness that people like Christopher Hitchens and Richard Dawkins, for goodness sake, Sam Harris, Daniel Dennett, and the others are offering in its place. The confused logic and argumentation. I'm simply buoyed in my confidence that God exists. And then last week we had Steve Meyer on. Week before, had about 20 minutes or half an hour with Alan Schliemann from Standard Reason, who had just been at the Discovery Institute, in a conference for 10 days surveying a lot of the new evidence that's come out that seemed to be just cutting off Darwinism. The neo-Darwinian paradigm right at the knees. And then with Stephen Meyer last week, talking about in more detail from his book, is it called The Signature in the Cell? Is that what it is, Melinda? The Signature in the Cell, or The Cell's Signature, something like that. Stephen Meyer, M-E-Y-E-R. About what science is demonstrating now about what it knows about the human genome and about genetics and DNA, and it turns out DNA is not destiny, and if DNA is not destiny, the entire neo-Darwinian paradigm is in peril. Because the paradigm depends, by definition, on genetic mutation to create novel features, which are then chosen for by natural selection. And this is how you get evolution moving forward. And Stephen Meyer is saying, look, at least at one level, the Cambrian explosion of life forms, variety of life forms, it isn't happening. And he actually thinks, though I don't think 10 years ago or maybe even 5 years ago he would have made such a statement, that the ground is shifting considerably. And I asked him, do you think there's a paradigm shift on this issue in the field, in the broad field, in the future? He said, yes, I do. I said, in your own lifetime? He said, yes, I think so. He was obviously buoyed. And as I look at the information, the kinds of evidence that's coming out, I'm sure there's a lot of people that are going to deny it or acknowledge it, but then try to find some gymnastics to give a materialistic accounting. But look, I think for fair-minded people, that isn't going to work. And so not only is the case against atheism growing considerably, the case against neo-Darwinism is growing considerably in spite of the power play that the kind of scientific aristocracy is using to keep those who disagree with the paradigm and want to talk about the problems of Darwinism from speaking. And that was a good part of what Stephen Meyer and I talked about, at least at the beginning of our time together last week. If you missed that interview, by the way, you owe it to yourself to watch it or listen to it. 2 hours with Dr. Meyer. And it was one of the most satisfying interviews I've done in a long, long time, although I've had some fun ones. This was rich, and I encourage you to listen to it last week for the first 2 hours of our broadcast. Go to str.org, and you can get the MP3 file. So when I see that, I'm thinking, wow, this is great. And then buoyed in the existence of God, buoyed by the scientific evidence now that it really seems to be drastically undermining the neo-Darwinian paradigm, and now the listening to academics of different sorts and presentations dealing with the historical reliability of the New Testament, and not just from the reliability of the Gospels themselves as four primary, independent primary source documents. When I say independent, not utterly independent, they shared material in some degree, but they're independent testimonies that are primary source documents of the history of the time. And to see all the reasons why these ought to be trusted as good historical documents, that if you cast these things out on the trash heap, you've got to cast virtually every ancient document on the trash heap for the same reasons and for whatever reasons you would consider Tacitus or Josephus or any of the others, ancient historians, and even some not so ancient, as reliable witnesses for those same reasons we can trust the gospel accounts, those primary source documents called popularly Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, in addition to the historical material we find in some of the other writings, say by Paul or by John, but especially by Paul, and what we can know about Jesus from entirely non-Christian sources, in addition to what we can know from those that are clearly Christian sources. And kind of to crown it all off, last week I mentioned that I was with Gary Habermas. We were having dinner together because we were both teaching together at the same event for Frank Turek. And at his presentation, he went over an argument that I'd heard before. I'd heard him give it before, but it just kind of – the change really fell into the meter for me at this point. And what it does is it demonstrates – not using the Gospels, but using what virtually all scholars acknowledge to be authentic writings of Saul of Tarsus, who later became known as the Apostle Paul, and the datings they give for those writings. And the two writings are 1 Corinthians and the book of Galatians. These are virtually uncontested as Pauline. And we know Paul died in the mid-60s. Now, what's important about this is that many have claimed that the myth of the resurrection was something that was added much later, after there was any opportunity for alleged eyewitnesses to gainsay it, and so to deny it. And what Gary has argued is that this is not a legitimate point of view historically, but actually it turns out that the declaration of the resurrection of Jesus Christ is so primitive that we can push it back with high level of reliability to be a proclamation that happened just within a couple of handful of years after the event itself. In other words, we can push it back that far. We can track it. And I'll tell you the way he does it, because I think he takes the crucifixion to be in 30. So when Paul dies, it's 65, roughly. So that's 35 years after the event. So we know that the testimony of the resurrection could be no later than 35 years after the event, because Paul talks about it in a number of places. The book of Romans, for example, chapter 1, declared with power to be the Son of God through the resurrection of Jesus Christ. We also see it in 1 Corinthians, and 1 Corinthians is the one that's significant here, because 1 Corinthians was written by general consensus in 55. So if Paul died in 65, that's 35 years after the event. If he wrote the Corinthians in 55 about the resurrection of Christ, that knocks 10 years off of it. It pushes the testimony of the resurrection of Christ within 25 years of the event. And this is what he writes in 1 Corinthians 15. He says, I delivered to you, verse 3. Oh, let me start in verse 1. Now I make known to you, brethren, the gospel which I preached to you, which you also received, in which you also stand, by which you also are saved, if you hold fast to the word which I preached to you, unless you believed in vain. For I delivered to you, notice the tense, I delivered to you. Sometime in the past, Paul delivered to the Corinthians, as of first importance, what I also received, that Christ died for our sins according to the Scriptures, that he was buried, that he was raised on the third day according to the Scriptures, that he appeared to Cephas, then to the 12, and after that he appeared to more than 500 brethren at one time, most of whom remain until now, but some have fallen asleep. Now that which he just cited, for I delivered to you as first importance, that which I also received, colon, everything that follows after that, that is in the form of an ancient creed. In other words, it reads like a creedal statement. It wasn't just Paul talking about stuff. In the original language, you can see there's a creed there. It's as obvious to people who read these kinds of things. So he is saying that when he first went to the Corinthians, he delivered them this already established creedal statement, which entails the resurrection of Christ. He wrote 1 Corinthians in 55, but when he wrote it, that's 25 years from the event, when he wrote it, he said, I delivered to you, that is, sometime in the past I delivered to you. When was it that Paul went to Corinth to deliver this message? 51. Now we're, knock off another 4 years, we are 21 years from the event. So when he delivered the message to them in 51, 21 years after the event happened, he said, this is the message I received from others. So the message and the creed go back before that. Now, how far before that does it go? Well, Paul tells us more in the book of Galatians, also another book that is largely uncontested as an authentic Pauline epistle. And in Galatians, Paul says that when he became transformed by an appearance of Jesus himself, he did not first go to flesh and blood to check out his message. Rather, he went to Arabia and apparently had some time with the Lord there himself. And then 3 years later, verse 18 of Galatians 1, went up to Jerusalem to become acquainted with Cephas and stayed with him for 15 days. And he also saw James, the Lord's brother. What do you think they were talking about? Do you think the issue of Paul's own experience with the risen Christ came up then? How could it not, when Paul says, this is the thing that I delivered of first importance to the Corinthians? Then he says later in chapter 2, he goes back 14 years later with Barnabas and Titus, and he goes up to see the so-called pillars to make sure that he had not been running in vain with the message that he was communicating. Okay, so there's a 14-year gap of time there between the first time he talked with the apostles in Jerusalem, that is, those people who were eyewitnesses themselves and had been trained directly during the earthly ministry of Jesus, and the time he first went up. If we take 14 years off of the 51 when he's talking to the Corinthians, that is 41 minus 4 is 37, if my math is right. In other words, the latest he could have gotten this message from the apostles was 7 years after the event. And indeed, he says Jesus appeared to him 3 years before that, at least. It looks like what scholars are doing now is they are pushing the testimony of the resurrection of Christ, this creed that Paul cites for the Corinthians in chapter 15, to within a handful of years after the event itself. In other words, they know that within 3 or 4 years after Jesus was crucified, there was a robust doctrine of the resurrection of Christ that was circulating in Jerusalem and Judea and moving out from there, which means it's of the most primitive sort. Now, that, of course, doesn't prove that the resurrection actually happened, but it does demonstrate that all of this stuff wasn't invented years and years and years later, centuries later, decades later. No, it was in circulation virtually immediately after the events happened, which means it was circulating at a time when there are plenty of eyewitnesses that could deny this claim if it were false. There was plenty of opportunity to produce the body of Jesus, if in fact it was still in the tomb. But it wasn't in the tomb, or they would have produced it. And it begins to look more and more like this myth of a rising Messiah is no myth at all, but a bona fide, legitimate, and authentic piece of historical information that was the thing that launched the early church to spread this message all over the known world at the cost of their own lives in many cases. I don't know about you, but I think that's pretty compelling, and that's why I'm feeling buoyed. 1-800-227-5278, you're listening to Stand to Reason. Friends, in 2 Corinthians, Paul calls every Christian an ambassador for Christ. And that's why Stand to Reason was founded. That's why we continue. And now our commitment to helping you grow in what we call the foundations of an ambassador, knowledge, wisdom, and character, has just gotten easier. Our new ABC Studies, that's Ambassador Basic Curriculum, gives you important information on presenting and defending your faith. In these three self-directed studies, we'll cover the groundwork of how you can be an agent of change for Christ. That includes tactics in defending your faith and in-depth information on sensitive topics like abortion, homosexuality, religious pluralism, relativism, and evolution. The ABC studies are designed with busy people in mind, so you'll see maximum results in minimum time. You'll be amazed how quickly you'll be ready to take a stand as a follower of Christ. We'll even certify you as an ambassador when you're finished. Now, to find out more about the ABCs, the Ambassador Basic Curriculum, call us today, 1-800, the number 2, and the word REASON. That's 1-800-2-REASON, or visit on the web at str.org. Hi, I'm Greg Kokel. You want to make a difference for Christianity worth thinking about? Well, Stand to Reason can help you do just that. We train Christians, just like you, to be effective ambassadors for Christ. But we rely on the support of listeners to continue broadcasting on the air and on the web. Your gift keeps STR providing training to you and other Christians to become effective ambassadors for Jesus Christ. You'll learn how to deliver a message that's accurately informed, develop a method that is skillful, tactical, and fair, and cultivate a character that is warm, attractive, and inviting. If you want to make a difference for Christianity worth thinking about today, both in the world and in the church, consider supporting Stand to Reason Radio. You can start supporting STR today by calling 1-800, the number 2 and the word reason, or donate securely online at str.org. That's 1-800-2-REASON. Show us Stand to Reason, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Greg Kokel, your host. And by the way, I made some comments about Gary Habermas and his areas of specialty. He's got a lot of stuff on his website that you can simply download, a lot of things that he's written, even books that are out of print. He's got a book on doubt, in fact, that is available there. And he's just got great material. GaryHabermas.com. Maybe com or org. One of the two, all right? That would be G-A-R-Y. And H-A-B, as in boy, E-R-M-A-S, Habermas. Good German guy. Gary Habermas dot, I'm going to say org just for, but maybe it's .com. In any event, you can just download lots of stuff there. And he's got some great stuff on the Shroud of Turin, which is a whole nother issue. We talked about at length at dinner, and he's quite... obviously conversant in that issue, but all right, let's go to the callers, though, and in Oswego, Illinois, Tim, welcome to Stand to Reason.
Hi, Greg, how you doing?
I'm doing fine.
Good. I saw you at the No Doubt Conference yesterday.
Yeah, in Indianapolis. I guess you've made your way back.
Yeah,
to Oswego. You know, I didn't realize you were the Oswego guy, and that's where they had the drag racing many
right.
years ago. I don't know if they still have it now.
No, they don't have it anymore, but
yes.
Sunday,
Sunday, Sunday, you know, WLS used to play that ad. That was when I was a kid back in the late 50s, early 60s. Anyway, what's on your mind, Tim?
Well, yesterday I asked you that, you know, a couple of the people that you had on recently discussing intelligent design, that I felt that they were kind of acquiescing or kind of going along with evolution, but just denying whether it could have happened by itself naturalistically.
Right, right. And actually, the only person I've had on from the ID movement recently was Steve Meyer, and Alan Schliemann from Stand to Reason was on the week before, but he's on our Stand to Reason team. But we've had others over time that have just about everybody we've had weigh in on this issue that has written on it.
Yeah. So anyway, you had asked me for some examples of what I meant by that, and
mm-hmm.
I couldn't come up with any on the spot there, but
sure.
I came home, listened to your podcast, and I've got a few quotes here from you.
This is regarding Steve Meyer's
well,
comments?
Well, there's a couple things from Steve, and then the other guy was Benjamin Weicker.
Oh, that's right. You're right. I stand corrected then. Three or four weeks ago, I had Benjamin Weicker on. Right.
Yeah. And then... I found something, I heard something out of William Lane Craig that really kind of disturbed me,
uh-huh.
And I'd like to share that with you.
But all right.
Anyway, give me a minute here to kind of set this up. During the last few minutes of your talk with Benjamin Weicker, you were kind of summarizing
mm-hmm.
and from his book and so forth, and something was said that you know he believes that Darwinism is false, but that evolution is a fact,
mm-hmm.
okay? Darwinism being, you know, the blind watchmaker thesis and evolution with naturalistic foundation. But you asked him to explain what he meant by evolution
mm-hmm.
being a fact. And
Yeah, that's the key question at that point. Right.
Yeah. So he went on to kind of explain that he said you could construct a scenario of descent with modification from the fossil record,
mm-hmm.
but you wouldn't know what the causes of the modification.
You know, now that you mentioned that, I do recall that a little bit. So, I mean,
yeah.
vaguely. And I don't – what did I say to him at that point?
I don't know if you said anything immediately, because then he discussed this Adam Sedgwick, an early evolutionist, believing that evolution was true, but that creation sort of culminating in human beings as the Earth developed in conditions that would allow for the succession of species.
Uh-huh.
And he was kind of using this, and it seemed like he was kind of going along with that idea that, you know, kind of evolution happened, but it, God kind of planned it so that it would
okay, so, but okay, now just so we're clear here, so that, and this is where terminology can kind of get a little fuzzy here. Evolution is the big buzzword, it's the alarm word. When he's speaking of evolution here, he is talking about descent with modification. That is, that we all came from a common ancestor or multiple common ancestors, there were different lines of common ancestry, whatever it is, the fossil record, Weicker claims, demonstrates that there was descent with modification, and so that kind of evolution is a fact, but it's clear that naturalistic processes were not responsible for it, so he would deny the blind watchmaker thesis.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so it's kind of like he buys half of it, but not the other half. Okay, would that be fair?
Yeah, I can see that case being made.
Yeah, and I think based on what you've told me about Riker's comments, I guess I'd have to say that he does believe evolution in the sense that there's descent with modification is a fact. He said it, and he gave the reason why, the fossil record. Now, I don't have any good reason to believe that the fossil record actually demonstrates such a thing. And last week when we talked it with Stephen Meyer, he mentioned that Richard Sternberg makes it really clear that the best example that they have of fossil record supporting Darwinian evolution or descent with modification in the mammal, the whale series, from the wolf to whale series or whatever, it turns out that it just can't happen. And when I wrote my article about Ida, and I talked there in length about transitional forms, there's a serious problem with making connections in what is referred to as deep time. How do you know one fossil is actually related to another fossil when there's 4 million years in between the two of them? And the only way you could know that is you have to assume evolution. So at this particular point, it sounds like you're right about Benjamin Riker's claim that he does claim that, and I think he's wrong in his claim for the reasons I just gave you and the reasons that other people that are colleagues of him will also give.
Okay.
So I got to keep this in mind, though, when I talk to some of these other guys, because just to say, did I get Riker right, as you did, you know, did we both get him right, that he believes in descent with modification? It sounds like he does. So,
okay.
So that would be an example there. That's
okay.
One.
Now, with Stephen Meyer, he had made a comment, and I'm kind of quoting. He says, the issue is not have things changed over time, and the issue is not whether or not organisms share a common ancestor.
Mm-hmm.
Design or no design is the issue.
That's right.
Did life arise by purely undirected process, or did it a guiding hand play a role
in
the development? But that kind of sounds like, again, to me, maybe I'm interpreting it wrong, but it sounds like he's saying, well, yeah, evolution did happen, but what we're questioning is how did it happen?
Okay, let me pick at words here a little bit, because I know these guys are very careful in the way they put things. What he actually said, according to your citation there, is that the issue is not this, it's that. What he's doing is he's telegraphing to the rest of the field that we are talking about this thing right here. That is the particular issue that he wants to discuss, which is origin of life, or in his case, the origin of the phyla in the Cambrian explosion. He said there is no naturalistic Darwinian explanations could be adequate to explain that.
Mm-hmm.
So he says, I am not arguing. And here's subtext for you. At this time, during this conversation, that there was no subsequent dissent with modification. That's not my project, is what he's saying. Okay. He is not weighing in on either side of that issue. And I think he's chosen his words carefully. He isn't meaning to say that he thinks there was dissent with modification. I think I know him well enough to say that he doesn't.
Okay.
He is meaning to say that I am not going after that issue, because that's what's going to happen is when you do that is everybody blows up about dissent with modification. They don't pay attention to his point.
Okay.
So he is isolating and focusing his argument. Now, if you could demonstrate that Darwinian methodologies or mechanisms are not adequate to explain the origin of life or the Cambrian explosion and the formation of all the phyla, the basic body types. Well, can you see how that background information, what if that is engaged and then accepted on the merits, how the background information is going to seriously undermine conviction that there was dissent with modification by Darwinian mechanisms after that?
Yeah.
And I think that's what he's after. He is not trying to bite off any more than he can chew at the moment, and he doesn't want to, draw fire from all directions. He said, let's just stick with this right now, okay? And that's his. That's a strategic element that I think a lot of these guys are employing.
Yeah, he just doesn't want the conversation to get off track and then he doesn't get, the main point across.
Yeah, it's kind of like saying, you're talking to a person who doesn't share your convictions, all right, a non-Christian. And eventually you want to get them to the cross, because if they don't get to the cross, if they deny the cross, they disregard the cross, well, then they're going to stand before God in all their naked guilt before him and be punished for their crimes. And that's not going to be a pretty picture. So you don't say, okay, here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to try to show you that you're going to hell without Jesus, which right away his defenses are up. You're going to say, look, I want to talk to you about the New Testament and some good reasons why we can trust that the resurrection happened. Now, if the guy gets convinced that the resurrection happened, do you see how this puts the claims of the one resurrected, Jesus, into a more compelling light?
Right.
So then when Jesus himself says, I am the way, the truth, and the life, no man comes to the Father but through me, and things like that, well, then they have more credibility. I think the same idea is going on here.
Okay.
So in the case of Meyer, I'm virtually certain that he does not hold to dissent with modification, but that isn't his project. Dealing with that is not his project right now.
Yeah, so I was just maybe reading a little bit too much into that.
I think so.
Yeah.
And in fact, when I talked to Alan Schliemann, who has just spent almost 2 weeks with these guys, like morning to night, from sunup to sundown or beyond, he said that there was hardly anybody that he met there that believed in dissent with modification.
Okay.
And so maybe Riker is an exception to that, but I don't think Riker was there.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
This was the core. There's one exception I can think of, by and large, this was not their view.
Okay. All right. Well, this thing about William Lane Craig, he's obviously a highly, highly respected Christian apologist.
Yeah, uh-huh.
I love his work. And he's got on his website some podcasts of some lessons that he's taught about the doctrine of creation.
Mm-hmm.
And in one of them, he makes the following statements. He said, I think Christians can be quite open to the different theories of evolution. And he goes on to say, I was once very antagonistic to theistic evolution. However, once we give up six literal days, referring to Genesis,
mm-hmm.
he says he can see that God could use any way that he wants to create.
Mm-hmm.
And if he chose to use evolution, so be it.
Mm-hmm.
Evolution would not be inconsistent with the Bible.
Mm-hmm.
And he says that there's no biblical evidence that, or it's not clear from the Bible that God created all the life forms by special creation. And then he gives this example. He says in Genesis, it says God said, let the earth bring forth vegetation and fruit-bearing trees. He
mm-hmm.
goes, notice that he said, let the earth bring forth mm-hmm. vegetation. And then with regard to the living creatures, where he says, let the earth bring forth living creatures.
Mm-hmm.
He says that could very easily be interpreted as not God. God's not saying here that he necessarily, by special creation, created the plants and the animals just poof.
Yeah, you know? Okay, well, let me, that I think is controversial, the way, you know, he's put this. Part of the problem is when he says theistic evolution and evolution could have taken place is you have to qualify the terms. You have to say, well, this is what I mean by evolution in this sense. Mm-hmm. Obviously, he doesn't mean the neo-Darwinian synthesis, because the neo-Darwinian synthesis is chance mutation and natural selection. Mutation making the novel features and natural selection choosing for them. And this is a process that can be taken as a whole is called the blind watchmaker thesis.
Yeah.
So you have descent with modification built in there. Now, clearly he doesn't hold to that because he holds to a non-materialistic process, God.
Yeah.
So he may believe that descent with modification is possible. And in principle, I would argue that descent with modification is possible even from a Christian perspective, because the scriptures don't speak any of the details. However, because of what we know about the nature of modification, God would have to be inserting information at different points, because the chance is not capable of providing the novelty that is necessary for the development of life on Earth. It just isn't. And there's not enough time for that. So there's
right.
got to be an investment of information. Now, if God injects information into the genome, it seems to me an act of creation.
Yeah.
When she says, so that's an act of special creation. So the devil's a bit in the details on this, and I'd wondered what Bill means when he said God could have used evolution, because he couldn't have used the blind watchmaker thesis, because
right,
then it's not a blind watchmaker. And so, and I have written about this, you know, on the internet about, you know, it's like there's two ways to get a full royal flush in poker. You can deal it by accident, or you could stack the deck.
Mm-hmm.
But stacking the deck is design, and dealing it by accident is not. And I don't see how you can do it by accident on purpose. You know, it seems like it does, design by chance is a contradiction in terms. The other thing I'd ask Bill Craig is what does he mean, like the earth brings forth? How can the, as if God just says, let the earth bring forth, and he's not involved in the details of what it takes for, how can the earth bring forth anything on its own?
Yeah, I mean, I kind of, the way he was saying it, he was kind of making it, kind of showing that from the text, since God doesn't specifically say how he created, that it could have happened, I guess, along evolutionary type of lines.
Well, I don't understand. How is it, even if that's vague, and I guess it is so far as it goes,
mm-hmm.
he says more. He says about creating according to its own kind.
Yeah.
But even though those verses are vague, he didn't just say, let the earth bring forth, and then all of a sudden the earth says, all right, let's make some
right.
stuff.
Right. I mean, obviously, yeah, something else would have happened.
It isn't like allow it to happen and the earth figures out what it wants to produce.
Yeah.
That could be a very general statement. And that's kind of a general statement to describe him making all the things that end up coming forth. But God is the only one that has creative power.
Yeah.
And these things are designed by a designer, and so God must have been personally involved in that. So I don't think that's going to rescue him.
Yeah.
The earth brought forth vegetation, plants yielding seed after their kind, trees bearing fruit with seed after their kind. God saw it was good. That's the verse 11 and 12. Let there be lights. When he says let there be lights, are we to presume that the lights just on their own turned on?
Yeah.
Doesn't that mean that he creates them? At least he initiates the process of them coming into being, whatever, like maybe that's the Big Bang, and the Big Bang then over time develops into these things because that's the way God directed it by setting the initial conditions.
Yeah, I mean, I really felt, you know, the whole kind of thing that he was saying, I thought was really strange coming from him. And
yeah.
I wish I had the opportunity to ask him what he meant by this and give him the explanation. Because, I mean, certainly, you know, give him the benefit of the doubt, you know, due to his credentials. But
here it is again. Let the waters teem with swarms of living creatures. And all of this let things, I don't think lets God off the hook as being the direct creator of those particular things.
Yeah.
He's right in saying there's not a lot of detail there. Here, verse 24, let the earth bring forth living creatures of their after their kind. It even in spite of that language, it has got to be God himself acting in very particular ways to produce particular kinds of things, because the earth and the sea and the sky have no capability in themselves to produce any of those things.
Yeah.
All right. So I would agree with him that the details aren't there. And if you want to have some kind of evolution in there, you've got to be careful that you're clarifying that it is not the materialistic evolution. And if it is descent with modification, you've got to explain the mechanism.
Right.
And since we know of no mechanism that can actually do this, inject information in the kind and the quality needed to create this development over time, then God, it seems to me that God has got to be personally involved in there. So I'm a little disappointed that maybe Bill wasn't more clear on this. However, I will say as a talk show host myself, sometimes you go for a thumbnail sketch and you know, you kind of say things where you mean one thing and you don't mean it to be taken further, and then you think back on it and say, gee, I wish I could have said that differently. I don't know. Maybe we can get Bill on the air here and just ask him about that sometime and see what his view is on that, because that does raise some questions. But other than that comment, I have no reason to believe that Bill Craig is something like a closet theistic evolutionist.
Yeah.
So
well, I wouldn't have thought so either. But yeah. Well, if you ever get a chance to talk to him, it'd certainly be interesting to see what he has to say.
Well, I will see him in a couple of months at the EPS conference. And in the fall, I might even be able to get a chance to talk to him before then, and we might have him on the air.
Great.
He'll be at Saddleback. Okay, I'm going to be speaking at Saddleback in 2 weeks or 3 weeks or something, first Labor Day weekend, and William Lane Craig will be one of the featured speakers there, along with many others. So I'll see if I have an opportunity to ask him about that. Okay, Tim?
Okay, thank you very much.
Great seeing you yesterday.
All right, you too.
And I appreciate your call. All right, got to go to break. More calls coming up in just a moment on Stand to Reason.
We are ambassadors for Christ. That's what Paul tells us in 2 Corinthians 5:20. An effective ambassador has three essential skills. First, an ambassador must have the basic knowledge necessary for his task. Second, this knowledge must be deployed in a skillful way. There's an element of wisdom, a tactical and artful diplomacy that makes his message persuasive. Third is character. His personal maturity and individual virtue will either make or break his message. Stand to Reason's mission is to help you develop the foundational skills in each one of these areas. In Essential Ambassador Skills, Greg Kokel will train you in all three of these areas to be an effective ambassador for Christ and to represent God's message of grace in a broken world. To order this unique message, call 1-800-2-REASON or go to our website, str.org. 800-2-REASON or str.org to order Essential Ambassador Skills by Greg Kokel.
Hi, this is Greg Kokel, and boy, am I excited to offer you my new book, Tactics. It's a book that I wrote to help you discuss your Christian convictions with non-Christians, and it outlines specific steps to follow that you can take that will help those conversations be less intimidating and more effective. And we've seen a tremendous response to this book, and many people have already told me how much it will help them. And I hope it will help you too. To get a copy for yourself or as a gift, simply visit tacticsbook.com. It's my aim to help you make a difference for the kingdom with this book. To order your copy, simply visit tacticsbook.com.
It's been a hard day's night, and I've been working like a dog. It's been a hard day's night, I should be sleeping like a log.
Get the fat out of your thinking, ladies and gentlemen. You can trim down to fight and weight every weekend here on Stand to Reason. Sundays 2 until 5. It's our live show, L.A. time, so make the adjustment if you're listening by podcast, usually, somewhere else. You can give us a call. 1-800-227-5278. Lines are pretty full right now, but we'll be getting to them in just a moment. And to yours if you want to keep trying, because lines clear up. We got 2.5 hours to go. You know, just a point here about whenever we talk about evolution, it is always critically important for you to be clear on the terms that you're using. In fact, I don't think it's helpful to use the term evolution anymore. It's too ambiguous. Could mean change over time. That's not controversial. Could mean microevolution, you know, that natural selection does have an impact on subsequent generations when you're talking about information that's already in the gene pool. This is why you can get groups of people that can kind of get sequestered off into one area and interbreed, so to speak, and certain characteristics seem to be prominent in that population. This is not controversial. You want to call that evolution? All right. Darwin did, microevolution. If you're talking about the molecules to man hypothesis, though, descent with modification, the blind watchmaker thesis, now that's something entirely different. So I think it's better to use those terms. Do you believe in descent with modification? Do you believe in the neo-Darwinian synthesis? Do you believe in the blind watchmaker thesis? Those terms are much more precise as terms of art dealing with the issues and don't have the ambiguity, I think, that these other terms have, and therefore they're much more helpful in our discussion. Let's go to Oklahoma and find the button here. Randy, welcome to Stand to Reason. Hi.
Hi, Greg. How are you doing today?
Doing good. Thank you.
And, well, first off, I just wanted to thank you for your ministry. I certainly appreciate it. I've become a bit of a podcast junkie here lately.
Okay. Glad to hear it.
I actually had to take a little bit issue with you because you've kind of ruined commercial radio for me. I can't get into my car and turn on the radio anymore.
Uh-huh.
I've got to bring my iPod and
well, good for you.
It in.
That means you don't have to listen to a whole bunch of commercials on commercial radio either, which is, I podcast some of the guys that I favor, like Dennis Prager, for example, and I talk about him quite a bit, so people, it's no surprise. That's a one-hour broadcast in real time. That's 35 minutes of actual talk. And when I put it on double speed, I can listen to it in less than 20. So that's one of the values of podcasts, so...
When you're putting podcasts on double speed, I think you might be a bit of a junkie yourself.
Yeah, that's right. Well, I don't get to listen that often, so, and I can put it on double speed on my iPod, you know, the new software for it allows you to do that. Anyway, so what's on your mind, Randy?
My question had to do with the free choices of Lucifer and Adam.
Okay.
I bring up the two of them because they seem to be the first folks who had the ability to make free choices.
Mm-hmm.
And what I'm having difficulty grasping is how either of them could have actually made a free choice. And I wanted to start with a couple of premises and see if we agree on the premises, and then kind of take from there the argument that I followed.
All right, let's give it a shot.
Okay, the first premise is that God created everything and everyone that was created, and that would be basically everything except for the three persons of the Trinity.
Yeah, no argument there.
Okay. And my second premise is that there's nothing that God cannot know unless it is illogical, and that would be like the area of a square circle.
Yes, that's right.
Okay.
Let me just back. I think that the more precise way to put omniscience is that God knows and believes all true propositions.
Okay, and that may
is
be
that fair?
That may be a bit of a point where we can refer back to after
I
come to my conclusion, and that might be something that perhaps you could clarify for me.
Yeah, and by the way, we might need to carry this over to next hour, so we'll just we might revisit this at the top because I'm seeing we're running out of time. Why don't you lay it out though, and then I'll think about it over the break.
Okay. From the two premises, I think it follows that God created the body and the minds of all beings,
mm-hmm.
and that He therefore knew exactly what it was that He created and how that thing would function.
Absolutely.
So in essence, my argument is that God created the mechanism by which each creature processes information. If a single individual then encounters thousands of pieces of information, which God also created,
mm-hmm.
has God not essentially determined what the choice will be by both creating the information and the processor?
Okay, that's the last point. Now, how does it follow that if God creates the information and the processor, that then the choices are determined unless you are assuming that the processor is operating mechanistically, which I don't assume.
I guess that is kind of that is the difficulty that I'm having, and the idea of it processing mechanistically is one that I can't taken my mind away from because of God's omniscience.
Okay. Omniscience has nothing to do with mechanism.
Well, what I mean by
that is knowing something doesn't cause anything to happen. There's no causal relation. Go ahead.
Well, what I mean by that is that God created the mechanism knowing what the mechanism would do.
Yes, but okay. When you use the word mechanism, you've already polluted the conversation logically in a certain sense, because the nature of mechanism is that it happens mechanically. So there's no choice in a mechanism. But let's just say God created the person knowing what the person would do. And if you leave it at that, then the question is open as to whether he could choose or not. But when you say that God knows what they will choose, it suggests that it is the knowledge that God has of what they will choose that causes them to choose what they choose, and therefore they're not free. And that's not the case, because knowing what's going to happen, even if you know it of a certainty, that it couldn't happen any other way because you know it, that is not what causes it to happen. The question is what causes it to happen. And if it's the free choice of a person that is the cause of the action, even though God knew the free choice in advance, it doesn't mean that the action wasn't free. I want you to chew on that thought for a minute, and we'll come back to you. I'm going to put you on hold because this is worthy of a little bit more discussion. I'm Greg Kokel. This is the end of hour number one. Hour number two just ahead of us. 1-800-227-5278 is the number. Stay with us for more of Careful, Clear Thinking Christianity.
I would like to ask you a very important question.
And that's what we do here on Stand to Reason. We'll ask questions and try to answer them. We stand to reason about them. And I'm Greg Kokel, the host, with you every Sunday from 2 until 5. This is our second hour. I welcome you who are listening now in the first hour in the American Family Radio Network. You missed, obviously, the first hour. You can get it on podcast at str.org. But I'm glad you've joined us. Of course, you can always follow us at Twitter. Just go to Twitter and search for Stand to Reason. And you can be my friend, too, on Facebook if you want to go there. Just type in my name and ask to be a friend, and we'll bring you on board, probably. Glad to have you part of the family. I want to start this hour continuing a call from last hour, and the call is with Randy in Edmond, Oklahoma. And Randy's you've raised a question about the issue of free will, especially as it pertains to Adam and Satan, right?
Yes.
And these are kind of like the paradigmatic examples of freedom, because they're the first guys who use freedom to sin that we know of, right? Human beings and angelic beings. So there you go.
Exactly.
So it's a good place to start. But your concern is that you're trying to make sense of their acts being free. And what you raised was the fact that God created everything. And correct me if I've got, you know, your argument wrong, but God created everything. That means he created these beings with their faculties that allowed them to choose, and created at least all the initial conditions that they would proceed from that might influence their decisions. And he also knows all of the decisions that they were going to make. And so if I understand you correctly, it almost seems like they are without freedom from two directions. one direction because God made, to use your words, the mechanism of choice and the circumstances that the mechanism would operate in. And it seems in that sense then that certain choices are inevitable given the mechanism. And the second way that they're determined would be that even so, God knows the choice that they're going to make. That is, the future is fixed from God's perspective of knowledge, given his omniscience, and therefore they're doubly destined or predestined or determined, and therefore there's no freedom. Is that a fair summation?
I think that's pretty fair. I don't want to get too caught up in the omniscience idea, although I know we spoke about that.
Yeah, and it's a thing that people do raise. So, but I have a response to both sides of this.
And I think that, you know, obviously we don't have a very strong parallel that we can draw on when it comes to God's creation of man, because there is no parallel. So I think that one immediately goes to the idea of man creating a machine or a computer, which, you know, you called a mechanistic idea.
Yeah, well, that's that was the word you used, mechanism.
Or processor, I think I said.
But, okay.
But same difference, I think.
Well, processor could be a mechanistic processor or an agent processing the information, but the nature of the conclusion or the nature of how the conclusion has come to or the action that follows is entirely different. I can give you information that you process and then make a decision on that is free, at least in principle. But I could also feed information into a computer, which it processes according to a certain set of deterministic laws, and therefore it gives a response to that's utterly determined by the prior conditions.
Right, so, and I guess that's the difference that I'm having trouble wrapping my head around. Are you saying then that God created the mind but didn't create the way the mind makes choices? Is that a good way to delineate?
God created the whole thing, but what he created, and this is going to the first part of your objection, what God created was an individual who had the capability of being a moral agent. Now, I want you to think of it this way. There are two types of causes in the universe, as far as we know. Philosophers refer to it as event causation and agent causation. If you think of dominoes falling, those are one domino strikes another domino, strikes another domino, strikes another domino. So if you ever ask why one domino fell and why it fell in the particular way it fell, you can always look back to the domino before it. And the domino A hits domino B in just the fashion to cause domino B to fall in a very particular way. And as long as domino A always acts in that way, then domino B will always act in its way. The actions are determined by the prior physical conditions. This is called event causation. It's the way machines work. And it's what makes science possible. When you think of the methodology of science, one of the things that's part of the methodology is called experimental repeatability. You've got to set up the same conditions and come up with the same results. But, of course, you could never get the same results from the same conditions unless events always followed similar patterns. All right? That is a deterministic system. Because as long as you set up the dominoes, so to speak, whatever they happen to be, in a particular way, you can guarantee the outcome because the outcome is determined by the prior conditions. You with me so far?
Yes.
Okay, so that's event causation. I don't mean to be patronizing, but sometimes I talk too long and I leave people in the dust.
No, I told you I'm a podcast junkie.
Okay, good. Well, so whenever there's event causation, it's always fair to ask, okay, what was the event prior to the one in question that caused it? And here we're saying caused in a deterministic way. And then when you get to that prior event, it's fair to ask, well, what caused that? And then what caused that? And what caused that? Because no event can initiate itself. It always has to have something before it. Now, of course, you realize you get an endless regress here, just going on forever into the past with nothing starting the motion at all. And you realize that in order to get the dominoes falling at all, you need a different type of cause which itself doesn't need a cause. That's right. The second kind of causation. It's called agent causation. Agents are the only thing that can initiate a string of causal events, things happening. They begin the process. The nature of an agent is that it is not determined by anything before it, and if it was, it wouldn't be an agent. It would just be another one of those dominoes falling, even though that might be a complicated mass of dominoes inside. Essentially, you have the same thing.
Sure.
Now, God created agents, and he created dominoes falling. You know, that's part of the Big Bang. He set the dominoes up in a certain way. He created them, set the conditions, and then the cosmos developed in a very precise way after that. And then he created, the things that respond to event causation first, although he was the initial agent. Then he created other agents, like you and I. And the nature of an agent is that it can make choices, and the choices are not caused by something outside. They owe their cause to the deliberation and choice of the agent. The agent can start a chain of causation. So by very nature, when you talk about God making the processor, he is not making the human processor. He is not making the human processor like we make a computer processor, because that's following event causation. He made a human processor who is capable of processing the information in an entirely different way, in a way that allows him to make judgments then and initiate action in different directions, and we call those actions free choices. There is nothing outside or before him that required it to be that way. The choice was that person's, and the whole chain of that causation started with him, which is why persons then could be blamed or praised for initiating the things they initiate. That's part of the nature of freedom. So when God created human beings, certainly he created the human beings and the circumstances around them and their capability for processing. But the way he created their capability of processing was very different from the way he created the capability of leaves to process sunlight in photosynthesis, where that follows event after event after event in a deterministic fashion. Agents process differently. They make choices, and therefore their choices are not determined in the sense that other things are determined. Human beings are then free agents. And so when Adam and also Satan sinned, they did not sin because something outside of them caused it to happen. It wasn't like they were a mechanism and there was some external stimuli that pushed the mechanistic button that caused them then to mechanistically do the thing that God disapproved of. Instead, the action was born within their own will, if you will.
Okay.
So, counter arguments or thoughts on that? Does it make sense there now how we're not talking about mechanism when we're talking about human beings or moral agents, which Satan would have been as well, though he was not a human being. He was still an angelic being that could make moral choices.
Well, my initial thought is that you've made my wife very happy. we're kind of amateur apologists.
And that was her answer. I gave her answer,
and,
right?
And we
and not yours.
You did. We enjoy bringing up so to each other, you know, some difficult to answer questions.
Well,
and seeing if the other one can play off.
I tip my hat to your wife.
Uh-huh.
She's saying I told you so right now, probably.
Yeah, but, well, she's not listening live right now.
Okay, but
as soon
she's going to be.
Podcast, she's going to have a smile from ear to ear.
I see.
Right,
okay.
Now.
Well, but does it make sense to you though? Do you see the distinction there?
It's still it's one of those things that's really difficult to wrap my head around. And the one thing that she had said was more or less that we can't understand how God can make someone who has a free choice. But that's not really something that we're going to be able to wrap our heads around.
Well, if what you mean is we don't understand how God makes it, well, I don't understand how God makes an apple or a pen or an atom,
right,
for that
right,
matter.
Right.
You know, so I don't understand how he makes stuff out of nothing. But then, but I can completely understand, and so can you if you think about it, that there can be a creature that makes free choices. And the reason you can completely understand that is you're one of those things. All you need to do is introspect for a moment, and you realize that you make – it just seems that you're making choices for reasons, and in most cases, you certainly could have done otherwise.
And I don't think that I would have ever labeled myself as a determinist. I just really wanted to have a type of logical or reasonable something to accompany my thoughts and feelings.
Well, there's nothing incoherent about the idea of there being an agent that is capable of initiating a series of events. We initiate things. I mean, that's the simplest way of thinking about an agent. And if we're the ones who are initiating it, then and we experience the initiation of things all the time, then by the very nature of the fact that we are initiating, there is nothing outside that is causing us to do this. Or else we'd just be another domino. We wouldn't be an agent. We'd just be, you know, another domino. Now, it may be that there are outside reasons why we do something, but reasons aren't causes. Reasons are the things in virtue of which we initiate the causal chain, if you will. But it's not. It isn't a cause. I actually had a talk with Bill Craig about this. I said, look at, there, you know, I think you can have backwards causation, which is kind of an odd concept. I said, sure, if God's omniscient, he knows what I'm going to pray. And so even before I pray it, he might be getting the prayer answer going so that right when I pray it, there it is on my doorstep. You know, like if you pray for groceries and then when you finish the prayer, you hear the doorbell ring and you open the door and there's a bag of groceries. Obviously, the person had to start buying and bringing the groceries before you even started praying. And I said, well, isn't that an example of backwards causation? My prayer is causing the answer to the prayer. And he says, no, it's not a cause. It's the reason God acted, but my prayer didn't cause God to do that. Because
right.
God's a person, he's not just a big domino that I just pushed over.
And it was actually William Lane Craig's discussion on middle knowledge, which I think you touched on briefly before, that kind of got the wheels turning on this one, where the question came in my own mind, if one were to encounter the same situation over and over again, would one make the same decision over and over again?
Mm-hmm.
And if the answer to that is yes, then you get into that idea of, you know, mechanistic processes.
Tempted by it, but it simply doesn't follow. I can understand the temptation, but why would somebody conclude if I had a good reason to choose something and the reasons didn't change every single time that the same thing came up, I chose the same thing, why would somebody conclude that that was a determined decision? It isn't determined, not in the precise sense we're talking about it. It's just that I have the exact same reasons, and I have no reason to do differently. So I make my choice to do that. No determinism. In fact, I guarantee you, Bill Craig would be on my side in this entire discussion.
Oh, I don't doubt that.
Yeah, I mean, I know him really well with regards to these issues, at least. We'd have some differences about the issue of freedom, but not so far as we've discussed. And he'd also make the point that just because someone knows in advance what's going to happen doesn't mean he caused that thing. You know, I was at the park a couple of weeks ago with my daughter, and they had this thing. I never saw it at a park before, but they had a kind of a concrete like a little car track, you know, so you can put your – it had all these loop-de-loops in it, and so you could put the – you put your car at the top, and it was like a roadster deal, you know, zoom, zoom, zoom down around the thing. And you know that if you put it at the top, every single time it's going to go down the bottom. You know that's the case, you know. But you know that even though you know every time it's going to go the same way, when you put it at the top, it's going to go down, your knowledge aren't causing that to happen. It is rather something – the knowledge itself doesn't cause it to happen.
Mm-hmm.
Something else is factoring in there. And even if God knows that you, Randy, are going to marry your wife – choose to marry your wife whenever you did, choose to ask her to marry you, even though he knows that in advance, the knowledge itself doesn't cause it. In fact, the way Bill would put it is, even though the knowledge is temporally prior to the action. That is, the knowledge comes before the action. The action is logically prior. That is, it is the action that is going to happen in the future that grounds God's ability to know it in advance. It's the action that causes the knowledge, if you will, not the knowledge that causes the action, even though the time element is reversed on that. Anyway, it's enough to chew on for now, Randy. Got to run.
All right.
Okay, appreciate the call, and my congratulations to your wife. Sounds like she got it right. Or at least she agreed with me, and if I'm right, then she's right. All right, go to break here for a moment, and then be back in 2 Corinthians. Paul calls every Christian in a... Friends, in 2 Corinthians, Paul calls every Christian an ambassador for Christ. And that's why Stand to Reason was founded. That's why we continue. And now our commitment to helping you grow in what we call the foundations of an ambassador, knowledge, wisdom, and character, has just gotten easier. Our new ABC Studies, that's Ambassador Basic Curriculum, gives you important information on presenting and defending your faith. In these three self-directed studies, we'll cover the groundwork of how you can be an agent of change for Christ. That includes tactics in defending your faith and in-depth information on sensitive topics like abortion, homosexuality, religious pluralism, relativism, and evolution. The ABC studies are designed with busy people in mind, so you'll see maximum results in minimum time. You'll be amazed how quickly you'll be ready to take a stand as a follower of Christ. We'll even certify you as an ambassador when you're finished. Now, to find out more about the ABCs, the Ambassador Basic Curriculum, call us today, 1-800-2 and the word reason. That's 1-800-2-REASON, or visit on the web at str.org. Hi, I'm Greg Kokel. You want to make a difference for Christianity worth thinking about? Well, Stand to Reason can help you do just that. We train Christians, just like you, to be effective ambassadors for Christ. But we rely on the support of listeners to continue broadcasting on the air and on the web. Your gift keeps STR providing training to you and other Christians to become effective ambassadors for Jesus Christ. You'll learn how to deliver a message that's accurately informed, develop a method that is skillful, tactical, and fair, and cultivate a character that is warm, attractive, and inviting. If you want to make a difference for Christianity worth thinking about today, both in the world and in the church, consider supporting Stand to Reason Radio. You can start supporting STR today by calling 1-800-2 and the word reason, or donate securely online at str.org. That's 1-800-2-REASON. With Christianity You Can Sink Your Teeth Into, Greg Kokel here on Stand to Reason. Whenever you talk about free will, friends, you have to be clear on what freedom involves. And free will just is the opportunity, the ability to choose, with nothing outside causing the choice. Now, there are further refinements that you can make in the discussion of libertarian free will versus compatibilism, but I think all sides agree that it's freedom if the agent initiates the chain of events. They cause things to happen. They aren't just kind of in the middle of a series of falling dominoes. And they're not just one of the dominoes. By the way, if that's what it means to be an agent, it means to be the one who can initiate, can make things happen based on the choice. That is, there's nothing happening before the agent decides, and then new things start happening. Dominoes start falling. An agent can act for reasons, but the reasons are not causes. They are simply the things in virtue of which a person acts. The reasons do not determine, in the strict sense of determine, what follows. The agent can always make a choice. Along that same line, let's talk with David in La Habra, California. David, welcome to Stand to Reason.
Thank you.
Yes.
Okay, the crucifixion of Christ,
Was it predestined or free will?
Well, it was both. and I'm not exactly sure how to make sense of that. I think it was predestined because the text actually says that, that this was a plan that God had actually set in place, that it was going to follow through the way God had in mind, but it was executed in virtue of free choices that people made. Now, how can you get people to act in a way that is free, yet is still consistent with a predetermined plan? And I'm not sure I can answer that question. I've heard there are a couple of different characterizations, and William Lane Craig has one, that makes total sense out of the notion of predestination in the sense you're talking about, predestination of God's, of Jesus' crucifixion and the free will responsibilities that people take for having participated in that.
Well, and Jesus said, if I asked my Father, there would be many angels coming down.
To rescue him, right. But since God's purpose was to allow Jesus to die for a good reason, then he didn't call on his angels. But,
well,
I'm
and
not
he
sure.
said it must be fulfilled what the prophets wrote.
That's right. Okay, I'm not sure how that those last two observations enter into the discussion about freedom.
Well, did Jesus give his life willingly, or was it predetermined?
He gave his life willingly, and that was part of the plan.
Right.
At some point, he participated in the plan. His decisions were consistent with the plan. It was his plan, after all.
Okay, so it's both. It's free will and predestination.
Well, the answer is yes to that, at least with part of your question. But when you're talking about Jesus freely giving his life, that was Jesus' plan to freely give his life. And so he predetermines the result by determining he will choose in a certain way.
It's kind of like a blueprint of a house. You can see what the house is going to look like, even though it's not built. But once it's built, it's identical to the blueprint.
Yeah, that's true, but that doesn't solve the problem of that doesn't resolve the issue of the eventuality of it being built, which is at the core of determinism.
this is confusing, but
I think you're right. But let me just before you jump in again, I just want to isolate one part of this, because sometimes there's three or four things going on at once, and if we can kind of fix a little part of it, we can move it out of the equation, all right? Jesus is God, and God predetermined in his plan that there would be an execution, all right? So Jesus, for his part, cooperates by making a choice of will to give his life freely when others are trying to take it. So he secures at least part of the plan that he wants by making choices consistent with his own plan. That's a free choice on his part that is not inconsistent with determinism. I could say I am determined to go with my family. I am determining it to be the case that my family and I will go to the Orange County Fair like we did a couple weeks ago or something. Now, half of that I can get done real easy. My half, I could just decide to go. So that can get fulfilled in virtue of my decision. Now, how do I get them to go? That's a different problem. And I think the same thing is true here. Part of this can be resolved just by saying Jesus decided. He decided in a way consistent with his plan. Now, how does he get the other things happening, like the bad guys wanting to kill him in a certain way at a certain time to fulfill the prophecies?
Let me ask a question. Did Jesus make the prophecies come true, or were the prophecies written before and they came true?
I think it's a false dichotomy, because I don't think it's the case that Jesus read the prophecies and then try to kind of, all right, I got to do this, I got to do that, I got to go here, I got to be such and so and do that. I don't think that's the case.
Or did God look down the future and say, this is what's going to happen?
This is one way to characterize it. Jesus made his own choices as well. So even Jesus as God, before he did any of these things, he knew these things were going to happen in certain ways that he was going to act. And so consequently, the prophecies did have to be fulfilled in those ways. Some of the prophecies, obviously, Jesus couldn't do anything about. He couldn't cause the manner of his death. The Jews killed by stoning, but his crucifixion was predicted long before in Isaiah and also in the Psalms. So that was a Roman form of execution. He didn't have any direct personal control over that. He didn't have any control over where he was born and all those other things. So there's many things that he couldn't control. There are other things, though, that I think he could have. I mean, I can't think of it right offhand, but I don't have any problem with the idea that
he said, "I have power to lay down my life, and
yeah.
I have power to take it up."
That's right.
Right. There's many things he said.
Yes, but he could have. What that means is he could choose not to resist the inevitable force of events that are facing him.
Right.
Now, in principle, he could have. That's why he said, "I could have called down my angels." But he chose not to because he wanted everything to play out according to plan.
Okay, I'm happy with a solution. It's a puzzle. Okay, and thanks for your program.
Yeah, I think it's a partial puzzle, and I think that, you know, that's we can maybe solve some little pieces of it and work around the edges a little bit. But I think, how does God actually secure all of these things? That is, you know, ultimately a mystery, but in a minute I'll explain one way to do it. Okay, Dave?
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you for the call. I think these are tough issues right here, freedom and responsibility and determinism and all that. How does God's plan and I think this is among the most intractable questions that people could ask me, and that's why I'm not so clever with answers. How is it that God secures a certain chain of events that he wants to have happen for his purposes, yet at the same time, people are acting freely when they do that, such that they're responsible? Now, I don't buy the deterministic angle. Some people go that way. Well, God just causes everybody to do everything, because then he would be responsible directly for their sins. And God doesn't tempt to evil, it says in James chapter 1. So there's got to be another solution. Now, William Lane Craig has a clever solution. I don't buy it entirely. But this is an example of how one might be able to resolve this kind of issue, where men are acting freely, but they still, in a sense, play into God's predetermined plan. And the way Bill explains it is, he says that God has knowledge of all possibilities. He has knowledge of all actualities. In other words, everything that the broad range of possibilities, every possible universe, he knows all those things that could be in principle. Then he knows all of the things that actually are going to take place. But in between these two kinds of knowledge, and I get the terms for them mixed up. I think one is called free knowledge and the other one is called something else. But in any event, in the middle of these two is called middle knowledge. And these are the counterfactuals of human freedom. In other words, these are things that people might have done under one set of circumstances, but don't choose to do under another set of circumstances. So somebody, you might say, well, if I offer Greg, Baskin-Robbins Jamocha Almond Fudge ice cream for dessert, will he take it? And the answer is yes. But nobody ever offers it to me. So that never actually happens. That's called a counterfactual of freedom. I might freely choose it under that set of circumstances, but those circumstances never present themselves, so it doesn't ever happen. So God knows, by the way, it isn't the case that I would accept anything. There's only a couple of different things I might accept. So even though it's possible I could accept liver, it's not going to happen because I don't like liver. So that's middle knowledge. So here's the way Bill uses it in this circumstance. God knows all choices that any free will creature that he would make under any set of circumstances. So there's all these kind of worlds that he might actualize, with all kinds of different choices people would make, and he gets to choose to actualize the world he wants, in which people make choices that comports with his plan. People make free choices that comports with his plan, and then he actualizes that world. And now he knows the free choices specifically, obviously, that everybody in that world that he actualizes are going to make, the people are going to make, and then he builds his plan into that. So he predetermines the outcome, even though people are making their choices. So that's quite clever. And I think it's has merit, and it's worth considering, and a lot of people like it. And I use it as an example of how you can see how there can be free actions, even though, in another sense, there is a predetermined plan of God. The two fit together. Now, Reformed people, Calvinists, aren't going to feel happy with that. They don't hold a free middle knowledge. They kind of subsume God's middle knowledge under another category. So in any event, some people will disagree. It's just for something to think about. I don't hold that view personally, but at least all the ways that Bill applies it, I do think God has the knowledge of counterfactuals, obviously, of human freedom, things that people might do but don't. But I don't use it in that way. All right, let's go to Los Angeles and Peter, I think. Hello, Peter.
Do you hear me, Mr. Kogel?
I do hear you.
Excellent. When I pick up Meyer's book on evolution, I'll call you after I peruse it.
Okay, this is Stephen Meyer's book, right.
Mm-hmm. Right. But today, I'd like to continue something that I began with you a few weeks ago.
Okay.
And that is the question, since you were, well, I would say, not to put too fine a point on it, sounding a little triumphalist in the beginning of your show, and I thought a non-believer should call and kind of try to curb your enthusiasm a bit.
Oh, I see. Now, the beginning of today's show you're talking about.
I don't know
if triumphal is the right word. I use the word buoyant, but that's all right.
Okay.
Topic is sola scriptura. And
Paul.
Sola
scriptura and Paul.
Yes, okay.
I don't think we did it justice.
All right. Well, that particular issue wasn't one of the issues I was feeling buoyant about, but that's
okay. Well, you brought up Paul's credo and things like that. And first of all, let me say, I do, as I said before, respect very much the intellectual structure built by the Christian faith. It's
uh-huh.
a marvelous thing.
Uh-huh.
And secondly, I also have a certain sympathy and empathy for people who are trying to make it through this veil of tears with any help they can, and mm-hmm. I don't want to deprive them of anything like faith so they can get through it. Life is hard.
Fair enough.
Now, with that being said, let us now get into the arena.
As it were.
Yes. You see, my point I was trying to get to last time is that the Bible, especially New Testament, suffers from a number of tremendous difficulties, not just contradictions and all these other things. Because, you see, the more I study, the less I believe, while you brought up in the beginning of the show, the more you study and listen, the more you're believing.
Well, I specified specifically what it was that I was believing. I was
right.
believing the existence of God. I was believing that the Neo-Darwinian synthesis was dying rapidly based on the merits, and I was suggesting that the New Testament documents can be historically reliable on their face, and that the resurrection was a very, very primitive doctrine of the church going to back within a few years of the events themselves that gives us strong reason to trust that the resurrection of Jesus of Nazareth actually took place.
Right. I'm talking about the latter, evolution another time.
Yes, okay.
The problems that I see and should bother all of your listeners, I think, if they're really trying to search for truth and not just trying to get comfort, which I respect.
Mm-hmm.
But when you're making a show for truth and using reason, so that's another standard, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Here we go. Paul is important to me because he's such a critical figure in the faith. And that scripture, and in Martin Luther's time, it became the term sola scriptura. This is it. This is the foundation. The scripture is the foundation. There's a problem there. And again, I'm not talking about contradictions or anything yet. Maybe we will. But there's a problem that always bothered me, and that is that the scripture itself does not refer to itself or to this major figure. Now, the founder, Jesus, talked about sending a paraclete for comfort, and he made other predictions about the temple being destroyed.
Wait, I'm confused about a sentence. Did you finish that sentence or not when you said the scripture itself doesn't refer to itself? And then
right.
it sounded like you... So yes. Was that an unfinished sentence?
No. It's one of my points.
Well, the Scripture does refer to itself if what you mean is there are writings in the Scripture about Scripture. All Scripture is inspired and God-breathed, for example, 2 Timothy chapter 3. So there you have a reference by Scripture about Scripture.
That's not enough.
Well, not enough for what? Wait, that's what I'm confused on.
It's
not
enough to be used as sola scriptura. What should be there is some testament by the founder that this document that's coming, because, you see, they're not just building a church. They're writing a book. And this book is going to be the foundation for thousands of generations later. We're not witnesses.
Actually, Peter, you're mistaken about that. You're mistaken about that, Peter, because, I mean, just on a factual basis, the writers of the New Testament were not trying to write a book. The gospel writers were giving an account on a scroll of the life of Jesus. The apostles who followed after to build the church were writing letters to individual groups of Christians, and it wasn't until the 3rd century or so that we know of, because we have examples of it, that the different letters and stuff, were particularly of the New Testament, were gathered together in book form called a codex.
The founder should have been making at least one reference that a New Testament is being written.
Why?
Because it's the foundation for all that comes after. For somebody from the Reformation, as Protestants are, that's basically all you have. The Catholic Church saw this problem 2,000 years ago and has the speakings of the Pope ex cathedra to help this along.
Okay, but just to point out, okay, Peter, first of all, the Roman Catholic Church didn't exist 2,000 years ago. Secondly, the idea of the Pope speaking ex cathedra was late 19th century dogma of the Roman Catholic Church. So they didn't see this problem and solve the problem. I mean, that's just not accurate with regards to...
For centuries, the Bible wasn't even read by the people. It wasn't even allowed to be read by the people.
I don't know
the
where,
average people.
Peter, I don't know where you're... If you're talking about centuries, like maybe the last couple centuries, it was mostly the Roman Catholic Church that taught doctrine and the people didn't read because they were
I'm
illiterate.
About
but,
Wycliffe and Jan Hus.
Oh, yeah, that's right. That's,
now you see.
That's true.
Okay,
that's 1,500 years after the fact, after Paul. So I'm still confused about your... It sounds to me, let me see if I get this right. I'm not trying to put words in your mouth. You're saying that the Bible couldn't be... the doctrine of sola scriptura couldn't be true because if it were, then those people who were self-consciously writing a book that was going to be the sole authority would have told us that the book is the sole authority. Is that right?
It would have been referenced that the founder... had said that at least one time. He talked about all other kinds of stuff.
Which founder?
Jesus.
But Jesus wasn't writing a book, so he's not going to make reference to a book.
No, but he would be making reference that a book shall be written, and by the way, Paul or some other figure will be very important.
Well, he does say something along that line, though it's not so much about the writing. He says in the Upper Room Discourse in John that he is going to send the Holy Spirit to those disciples so that they can recall all of the things that he has taught them, and then they can relate them to other people. He doesn't make mention of the book to be written, but I don't know why that's significant.
Well, because the book is the thing, and Paul is the man. The credo that you talked about, by the way.
Actually, Paul is not the man. Paul is not. He is one of the men. Jesus is one of the men. John is one of the men. Peter is one of the men. Mark is one of the men.
No one is as important as Paul, as you were saying earlier in the show.
No, I think you're right about that in terms of the contribution that they made to the New Testament text. But you are saying Paul is the man, but this is just not accurate. He's one of the important people, and he's written more than anybody else. Actually, I think Luke has written more than anybody else, not Paul, if you want to count the words, but between Luke and Acts. But it isn't just Paul. Pardon me?
He talks about Paul.
It's not sola Paul. It's sola scriptura. That's the difference.
Right. Well, look, in that credo, I know time is limited. These are hard issues, and now we're really playing hardball, but you
allow
that.
I'm not playing hardball. Everything's fine with me, but I think you're making the issues more difficult than they are.
Now, in that credo, that's so important, and Paul's the one who says it, I grant all that, He makes a monumental omission, for example, why I have trouble with that, right from the beginning. He says the phrase, and of a woman born. Yet he doesn't say anything about the second most important thing in the biblical New Testament history, the incarnation. Now, you said he meets with Peter and James, the brother. They all must know about the virgin birth. This would be very important in Paul's project of convincing people.
Mm-hmm.
Yet he doesn't bring it up ever in any of his epistles.
Okay. Well, there's a number of things it may be strange, and there are a number of things that are written in the Gospels that Paul himself doesn't engage because he's got his own project. And
but this is important. This is crucial.
There are lots of things that are important, but there are lots of things. I don't know what to say to you, Peter.
Let me just say this.
All right.
If there were no incarnation, there would be no all-important resurrection,
I understand, Peter, but here's the problem. First you state Paul is the main deal and that he's the deal. He's the main one. He's the everything. And then you claim, but he doesn't mention these other things that are critically important. My response is, you got it wrong. Paul isn't everything. The other guys are part of the package, and the other guys who are part of the package mention these things. So when you take the whole corpus of Revelation, the things that Paul says, which are vital, and the things that the others say, which are vital, then you've got the whole program. Now, whether you believe the program or not is an entirely different issue. Whether that book itself that we call the New Testament and the Bible, and which includes New Testament, is the only authority is an entirely different question. And in my mind, it makes absolutely no difference whether the writers, when they're writing their individual letters, say, by the way, in 40 or 50 years or 60 or 70 years, these are going to all be gathered together. And once they're all sewn in one piece, then that's going to be the Word of God and the sole authority. Makes no difference whatsoever to the question of whether that which was ultimately left behind is the only authority to speak for God, or whether there is some other authority. These are two entirely different issues. Peter, we'll have to pick it up more next time around. I thank you for the call, and it didn't feel like hardball to me. If you meant by that, you know, like banging heads, I enjoyed the conversation, and I thank you for that. We have to go to break, right? Okay, let's go to break. More questions and calls after this.
We are ambassadors for Christ. That's what Paul tells us in 2 Corinthians 5:20. An effective ambassador has three essential skills. First, an ambassador must have the basic knowledge necessary for his task. Second, this knowledge must be deployed in a skillful way. There's an element of wisdom, a tactical and artful diplomacy that makes his message persuasive. Third is character. His personal maturity and individual virtue will either make or break his message. Stand to Reason's mission is to help you develop the foundational skills in each one of these areas. In Essential Ambassador Skills, Greg Kokel will train you in all three of these areas to be an effective ambassador for Christ and to represent God's message of grace in a broken world. To order this unique message, call 1-800-2-REASON or go to our website, str.org. 800-2-REASON or str.org to order Essential Ambassador Skills by Greg Kokel.
Hi, this is Greg Kokel, and boy, am I excited to offer you my new book, Tactics. It's a book that I wrote to help you discuss your Christian convictions with non-Christians. And it outlines specific steps to follow that you can take that will help those conversations be less intimidating and more effective. And we've seen a tremendous response to this book, and many people have already told me how much it will help them. And I hope it will help you too. To get a copy for yourself or as a gift, simply visit tacticsbook.com. It's my aim to help you make a difference for the kingdom with this book. To order your copy, simply visit tacticsbook.com.
He's a real nowhere man, sitting in his nowhere land. Making all his nowhere plans for nobody. Doesn't have a point of view.
Greg Kokel back with you here with the show that turns your mind on. And a very enjoyable call just a few moments ago on the issue of Sola Scriptura, which in a sense we didn't quite get to. I don't completely understand the argument. Well, let me back up. I understand it. I don't get the power of it or the cogency of it, that in order for the Bible to be the sole authority from God on matters of faith and conscience and teaching, whatever, the sole authority, that the Bible has to say that the Bible is the sole authority. It just doesn't follow. If I said that the Bible is the only source of truth of any kind, yet my statement is intended to be a statement of truth, and my statement is not in the Bible, then we have a self-refuting situation. But the claim is not that the Bible is the only source of truth. It's that the Bible is the authoritative source for information about God, and there is no other. That is, there are no other places that we get information about God that bear authority. There may be other places that we get information about God. I may give you information about God because I'm reflecting on Him and I have some accurate views, but they are not true because I have the authority to say so. They are true if they are true because my reasons for them support the truth of the statement. That's different from authority. When you have an authority, it is true in virtue of the fact that the authority says so. And there is only one thing, as it turns out, it seems to me, that is true simply in virtue of it saying so. And that is those things that are words from God. Now, the Bible claims to be the Word of God, and if it is, then it is authoritative in virtue of its source, and it is true just because God says it so. There can be other true things, but they are not true by authority of that sort. And if anybody knows of any other source of authority of that sort, that the statements are true simply in virtue of the divine authority that speaker has to make the claims, then I'd be glad to entertain the idea. I know this claim has been made by many. It's made by the Roman Church, given certain stipulations. It is made by the Watchtower Society. It is made by LDS. It is made by other Christian Science, etc. And just for clarity's sake, I am not putting all these groups together as if they're the same. I am simply grouping them for this one characteristic, that is, they claim to be an authority in themselves to speak for God. Since I have no good reason to believe that they substantiate their claim, and I have good reason to believe the Bible substantiates its claim, it then is the sole authority, sola scriptura, is what follows. And again, it makes absolutely no difference to that argument whether the book, when taken as a whole, makes the claim for itself. In Santa Barbara, Victor. Hello, Vic.
Greg.
How you doing?
Pleasure as always.
Thank you, sir.
Getting back to the enigma of free will.
Okay. Didn't you want to talk about Francis Schaeffer?
Yeah. I want to get into that.
Okay, we need to stick with Schaeffer because we're tight on time for one, and the enforcer's already getting angry if you change the topic.
No. This is what Francis Schaeffer is talking about, I think.
Okay.
He is talking about free will.
Okay.
That I'm sure you know about his books and things.
I was deeply influenced by them.
And you read his Christian Manifesto, right?
I read parts of it. We have I'm getting a signal here, 3 minutes, so we want to get cut to the chase here.
Well, what Francis Schaeffer seems to be saying is that there are two different blueprints for social organization.
Okay.
One would be the divine blueprint, which allows for free will, and the other one would be default or derivative or natural blueprint, in which, agents forfeit their status as agents and become indistinguishable from the dominoes.
Well, if what he's saying, and this is a little bit new to me about Schaefer, so you know more about this than I do, but if what he's saying is you can either have a world in which God creates agents, and therefore there's the possibility of freedom, or you have a materialistic realm in which there is nothing outside of matter and motion, and then you are stuck with event causation, and then there is no free agency at all, I think he's right. Materialism equals determinism.
Could it be that people who are being abandoned to a reprobate mind become indistinguishable from the dominoes?
No, I don't think so. I think that even though they are abandoned to the reprobate mind, that is, God no longer restrains them from following their most base fallen impulse, they are still creatures who make choices for which they're responsible. Their natures may be, they may make their choices in virtue of their natural inclinations. They may be following, in a sense, their fallen instincts, if you will, but they are still decisions those people are making as moral agents. They are initiating causal chains, if I can use that language, and so therefore they're genuine agents, and God will hold them responsible.
Can I read something from Francis Schaefer?
Yeah, sure. If you do it briefly.
All right, here's very quickly. He seems to be he presupposes determinism, what you call dominoes. This is what he says, quote, "The worldview that the final reality is only material or energy shaped by pure chance, inevitably, that's the next word I would bring to you, mathematically, with mathematical certainty, brings forth all of these other results."
Oh, I agree entirely. He is saying if the fact of the matter is the material world is all there is, then all you have is event causation and there is no freedom. I agree entirely with that. Now, he's only talking about the consequence of a worldview. And if that's the case, then you can't even know that materialism is true because rationality can't function in a deterministic world. You believe what you're determined to believe. You never come to conclusions as a free agent. Rationality is gone in a world that is simply matter in motion, materialism. However, it appears that there is free agency. Therefore, there must be more to the world than matter in motion. That's his argument. There you have it. I mean, I think it's pretty straightforward. I agree with Schaefer in this regard, and I thank you for bringing that to my attention. He is simply talking about the eventuality of a particular kind of worldview. And he's arguing here, I think, as a presuppositionalist. On the materialistic worldview, there's no freedom. But there is freedom, therefore the materialistic worldview must be wrong. Thank you, Victor, in Santa Barbara. Hour number 3 just ahead of us on Stand to Reason. Don't go away.
Where's the beef?
All right, friends. Welcome back to the show. Greg Kokel on Stand to Reason. The place to give your mind a workout, which is why I've said that this isn't the show for everyone. But for more and more of you, increasingly, I say that because it hurts to have to think. And sometimes you just want to listen to music or something. But I'm glad that you've tuned us in. This is our third hour. If you've missed the first 2 hours, str.org has, come Monday, tomorrow, we'll have the podcast. And so you can download that. In fact, if you'd like to, you can subscribe, and we will ship the podcast to you every week automatically. That's how that works. Also Monday on a video blog of this opening commentaries, is that right? We have... they can sign up for the video blog for Monday. I'm getting a sign here that I don't understand what it means, so I'll tell you in just a moment when I get the deed. I still don't understand. Sorry. We do have a video blog, and some of you might have noticed that, and I answer questions that are posed to me on the video blog, and I think that's posted on Mondays. Oh, Melinda's saying, yes, you got it, you idiot. That's what I was trying to communicate through the window. All right, well, see, even us, well, I'm a little bit slow on the uptake sometime, but I usually figure it out eventually. So not only do you get the podcast for the show, but the video blog in which I answer questions, and you can look at the Talking Head, that's also posted for your edification. For the record, it's GaryHabermas.com, and the Enforcer has just visited that website to find the article that deals with the issue that I talked about at the beginning of the show, the argument from 1 Corinthians 15 and from Galatians chapter 1 and Galatians chapter 2, that the account of the resurrection in a creedal form, which means it was developed and formed into that, took time to do that, can be dated as having been in circulation just within a handful of years of the event itself, showing that the testimony of the resurrection of Jesus Christ is one of the most primitive details of the teaching of the early church. In other words, it wasn't made up in the second century or the end of the first century or 20 years later or 10 years later. It was circulating at a time when the eyewitnesses had a chance, and hostile witnesses had a chance to put this myth to bed, if in fact it was a myth, which indicates that it probably was not. I recently had an insight that I want to share with you here as we start our third hour together into why materialists, that is people who don't believe in God and souls and demons and angels and heaven and hell and the afterlife and all of that, nonsense to them. They believe in what you can experience with the five senses, and that is the material realm. That's their metaphysical view. Metaphysical views are views about what you believe is real, and a materialist believes that the only thing that is real is matter in motion. So you have Richard Dawkins, for example, and Christopher Hitchens, for example, and the atheists in general and Enlightenment types in general hold to this view, and materialism is the view that at least methodologically drives modern science. That means you can believe in God if you want, or souls or angels or afterlife, whatever, and you could pray in your closet if you'd like, but when it comes to doing science, you cannot make reference to agency outside of the natural realm. You have to make reference to just basically molecules in motion driven by natural law. And materialists, then, have a tremendous amount of confidence that science will answer all of the relevant questions, because all of the relevant questions only entail things that are physical, since only physical things exist. And since science speaks to that, eventually it will be able to address everything, at least in principle. There's no need, in other words, for sticking God in the so-called gap. And what was profound, it seems to me at least, regarding this insight that I'm about to share with you, was that Christians are responsible for the confidence that materialists have that science will fill the gap. And they're responsible because of a persistent error that Christians make regarding the relationship of faith to reason. The error itself is evidenced in this question, and I hear variations of this all the time. And the question is, if there is so much evidence for God or Jesus or the resurrection or the Bible or whatever, fill in the blank, then what's the point of faith? If our evidence for these things amount to giving us knowledge of facts that we can know, then it squeezes faith right out of the equation. Now, I want you to notice something very important about this statement, and this statement is made all the time by people who ought to know better, it seems to me. What this statement does is it puts faith in opposition to knowledge. That is, there's an inverse relationship between the two, such that when you increase one, you decrease the other. You increase knowledge, faith decreases, because you can't have faith in what you know. Faith is what you exercise when you don't know. So if you know like 90%, then it's that 10% you exercise faith in. If you know 95%, notice how faith got squeezed out a little bit more by 5%. You can only put 5% faith. If you don't know hardly anything, let's say you only got 50% knowledge, you got 50% room for faith. All based on the idea that when you increase one, you decrease the other. And this casts faith as a kind of religious wishful thinking. Now, this is something I've talked about before. In fact, I've written an article on it called Faith is Not Wishing. You can find it on our website, which develops this point a bit. Because wishful thinking is all that's available to you when you don't know something. You don't know it, so you just have faith. But once you know, it doesn't make any sense to say you believe it by faith. That's the view. So the ancients thought, for example, thunder was the sound made by the gods fighting or whatever. They didn't understand meteorology. Instead of knowledge, they had faith. Now we know the scientific facts about thunder, so there's no more room for faith on that matter. We've got to restrict our acts of faith to some other area of ignorance. Notice how this equation works. Knowledge what you know, faith is reserved for ignorance. And I think this is what some people think Paul meant when he said we walk by faith and not by sight. We walk by believing faith, not by knowing sight. And if we know, it's no longer faith, but knowledge. Faith and knowledge in this equation are at opposite ends of the spectrum. Of course, this is clearly false in a moment's reflection. The opposite of knowledge is not faith, it's ignorance. And the opposite of faith is not knowledge, but unbelief. But it's also not what the Bible teaches about faith. And this is the salient point here. There are many Christians who have a view of faith that is not biblical. In fact, it is contrary to the Bible. And this view of faith that's contrary to the Bible ends up giving aid and comfort to our ideological enemies, as it were. So, what does the Bible teach? The Bible teaches that faith is trusting in what you know to be true because of the evidence. Let me say that again. The Bible teaches that faith is really an act of trust in what you have good reason by the evidence to know to be so. And this is the point that I've developed at length in this article you can find at str.org entitled Faith is Not Wishing. So I'm not going to pursue the details here except for to maybe give you one or two examples. Jesus said in Mark chapter 2, in order that you may know that the Son of Man has the power to forgive sins, because he had just said to the paralytic, your sins are forgiven. This annoyed people. Of course, nobody could see whether the sins were actually forgiven, right? So he says, in order that you may know that I have the power to forgive sins, I say to you, take up your pallet and go home. The act of healing was something they could see to secure the reality, the knowledge, the certainty, if you will, the fact of something they couldn't see. Forgiveness of sin. And it was this that inspired their acts of trust. It wasn't that they were ignorant about forgiveness of sin now. Quite the opposite. They had knowledge that sin could be forgiven, and this is precisely why they were able to exercise trust. It's because of what they knew, not because of what they didn't know. So there's one case history. Another one is Acts chapter 2. Pentecost Sunday. I guess it was Pentecostal Sunday, too, because they're all Pentecostals then. And Peter is giving his message, and he is talking about the resurrection of Christ, and he's talking about the visible effects of the Spirit on their lives, the sounds that the people saw and heard, the manifestations that they saw and heard. So there were sounds and there were tongues of fire. The apostles were speaking in other tongues, languages, and so these were all supernatural manifestations. Peter says, we're not drunk. This is the Holy Spirit. This is a fulfillment of prophecy. By the way, another evidence. So he gives the evidence of the manifestations they could see and hear, evidence of fulfilled prophecy. And Jesus rose from the dead. This man you crucified, God raised from the dead. That's another proclamation of a evidence, the empty tomb, the resurrection of Christ. And this was also prophesied. David the psalmist spoke of it, another evidence. So he gives evidence after evidence after evidence. Read it yourself, Acts 2. And then he says, he concludes this way, let all the house of Israel take a big leap of faith, because you can't know any of this. No, of course not. He says, let all the house of Israel know for certain that God has caused him to be Lord and Messiah, this Jesus whom you've crucified. So here's another case where there is no leap of faith. There isn't faith that is attached to ignorance, but rather an act of trust that is attached to knowledge, and the knowledge is based on the evidence. So, now my point about atheism and materialism. Here it is. The atheist looks at the equation about faith and knowledge in exactly the same way as many Christians do. They say there are things that you can know, and therefore there's no need for faith. Faith is what you use when you're ignorant. Now, what has happened in the last years, decades, is that the things that we are ignorant about has decreased. Therefore, on this other errant definition of faith, the things that we can actually exercise faith in has decreased also, because science has explained it. And so all of those things that we might have in ignorance posited God for, now science has explained them. And in fact, they have explained so many things that seemed to need God to account for them that there is now less and less for God to do on this view of faith. As a result, the God hypothesis then has less and less explanatory power, because the mysteries are giving way to knowledge, and we have science to thank for that. And given that as knowledge increases, the opportunity for faith decreases, and if we keep moving forward like we've been, pretty soon, can you see, friends, there won't be any questions left to which God is the answer. Think of a scientific knowledge like a balloon continually expanding into an empty room. And the empty parts is kind of like the ignorance that we put religious faith in. And the bigger the balloon gets, the less empty space there is, the less ignorance in which we put our faith in. And so pretty soon the balloon has expanded so much it simply kind of pushes all the emptiness or ignorance out and fills the room, and now where's room for faith? There's nothing left for faith in that sense to explain. That's the way they're looking at it. They look at the equation just like a lot of Christians do, and they're buoyant. They're exuberant. And I am completely sympathetic, at least in principle, to the atheist point here. If this is the way it is with faith and knowledge, then our train is slowly coming to a halt, ladies and gentlemen. The gaps at least in principle, will all be filled. And religious people can keep believing all they want, but their faith doesn't little work for them other than make them feel good. In Marx's words, their religion is the opiate of the people. That's what we're facing on this view, which, as I pointed out, is not the biblical view, but is the view of a lot of Christians. Now, on the contrary, if it turns out that faith is not opposite to or contrary to knowledge, then, watch this, the expansion of our knowledge by science or by any other means is no threat. If faith involves trusting in what we know, then the more we know, the more opportunity we have to trust. Now, I would never have been able to put my trust in a pilot, for example, like I did yesterday flying out of Indianapolis, or an airplane, if science had not given us the knowledge pertaining to aerodynamics and engineering and that kind of stuff so that we can make airplanes to fly in. I couldn't trust them. I couldn't put my faith in them unless science made it possible for those things to happen. Then I climb into the plane and I fly to LA in 4 hours. I think, cool, it's better than walking. If doctors had not explained their knowledge of medicine, I'm sorry, if they had not expanded their knowledge of medicine, diabetics could not put their trust in insulin in order to be rescued from what would otherwise be a debilitating illness. Notice how on this understanding, the biblical understanding, as knowledge increases, the ability to trust increases. The ability to exercise biblical faith, which is active trust. And the more we know about the intricate design of the universe, the reality of Jesus the Nazarene, the historical fact of the resurrection, all as well-justified true beliefs, the more we can put our trust in the designer who became a man in Jesus and who rose from the dead to rescue us from the debilitating and ultimately deadly disease of sin. No wishful thinking here, no leap of faith, just a reasonable step of trust, trusting something we have good reason to believe is true. That's the biblical view. And it does not aid and abet the atheist. I'm Greg Kokel. You're listening to Stand to Reason. Friends, in 2 Corinthians, Paul calls every Christian an ambassador for Christ. And that's why Stand to Reason was founded. That's why we continue. And now our commitment to helping you grow in what we call the foundations of an ambassador, knowledge, wisdom, and character, has just gotten easier. Our new ABC Studies, that's Ambassador Basic Curriculum, gives you important information on presenting and defending your faith. In these three self-directed studies, we'll cover the groundwork of how you can be an agent of change for Christ. That includes tactics in defending your faith and in-depth information on sensitive topics like abortion, homosexuality, religious pluralism, relativism, and evolution. The ABC studies are designed with busy people in mind, so you'll see maximum results in minimum time. You'll be amazed how quickly you'll be ready to take a stand as a follower of Christ. We'll even certify you as an ambassador when you're finished. Now, to find out more about the ABCs, the Ambassador Basic Curriculum, call us today, 1-800-2 and the word reason. That's 1-800-2-REASON, or visit on the web at str.org. Hi, I'm Greg Kokel. Do you want to make a difference for Christianity worth thinking about? Well, Stand to Reason can help you do just that. We train Christians, just like you, to be effective ambassadors for Christ. But we rely on the support of listeners to continue broadcasting on the air and on the web. Your gift keeps STR providing training to you and other Christians to become effective ambassadors for Jesus Christ. You'll learn how to deliver a message that's accurately informed, develop a method that is skillful, tactical, and fair, and cultivate a character that is warm, attractive, and inviting. If you want to make a difference for Christianity worth thinking about today, both in the world and in the church, consider supporting Stand to Reason Radio. You can start supporting STR today by calling 1-800-2 and the word reason, or donate securely online at str.org. That's 1-800-2-REASON. You, doing that thing you do, Greg Kokel back with you here on Stand to Reason. And, you know, this is one of those songs that gets stuck in my mind and I can't get rid of it. Saw the movie years ago, That Thing You Do. And I, what I thought was amazing about this movie, because I'm a, you know, I'm a child of the 60s. Actually, I was a teenager of the 60s. So the Beatles hit this country when I was 13 years old. So, I mean, this is very real to me. When they made this movie about a fictional musical group who had this single hit called That Thing You Do, I loved this song because it sounded to me like a Beatles song. They just had the riffs and the rhythm and the beat and the chords, and it just sounded like one that the Beatles would have written. And so it just fit. It was a fun story. And also, first time I ever saw Liv Tyler. Liv. L-I-V Tyler. You know, the Lord of the Rings. What do you call those things? Not Hobbit, but the other things. I'll think of it in a minute. I know everybody out there listening to this is shouting the word elf. That's right, elf. Took me a while to get it. All right, let's go back to the phones here and to Springfield, Missouri. Mark, welcome to the show. Glad you called.
Hey, Greg. Thanks for taking my call. And I want to just thank you again for your ministry and everything you guys do there at Stand to Reason. You guys have been a real blessing. I feel like a student of yours for many years.
Well, great. I'm very flattered by that. Thank you, Mark.
Great. Well, listen, I just had a question, and love always the different interchange you guys have, but one of the questions that you talked over the past year or two is people will call in talking a little bit about different views of the end times and so forth, and a very sub-point that kind of gets brushed over real fast during those discussions is you'll talk about how that you tend to view the New Testament in light of the Old Testament.
Right, uh-huh.
And so my question is kind of a two-point question. The first one is, how does that jive with the idea of progressive revelation? And then second, how does that, you know, handle passages like in Hebrews, specifically like chapter 1, where it says, hey, in these last days, God has spoken to us through his Son.
Right, well that, and, okay, sorry. Ahead. I was going to say that those are both the same issue. Because progressive revelation, pardon me, just is the notion, that it entails the notion that you get a final or most full revelation in the person of the God-man Jesus. And by the way, there's something that always troubled me a little bit about that Hebrews passage, and that is that there were a whole lot of people that wrote text following Jesus, you know, Peter, John, Paul, Luke. You know, so, but I think the way to take that is not that Jesus is the once and for all final revelation, because there'd be no place for apostles writing after that, if that were the case, but that Jesus is the fullest, revelation of the Father and the most definitive. Did we just lose Mark? Mark, I apologize for that. So, call back, all right? And, we'll put you right back on. There he comes, I think. And that Jesus is the most, what was I saying, definitive revelation of the Father. If you read a little further, it says that he is the exact representation of his nature. And John says in the beginning of his gospel that no one has seen the Father at any time, but Jesus, the only begotten Son, has revealed him. So I think that's in that sense. But I think it is kin to your first point in that there is progressive revelation. What I mean here by the idea that you must read the New Testament in light of the Old Testament is the Old Testament sets a foundation for what is to come. Now, there is more to come, of course, but it builds on the foundation of the Old Testament. The Old Testament makes certain promises pertaining to the ultimate solution to the problems of mankind, first one dealing with guilt of man before God, and so there's a individual salvation there, and then there's a restoration of the world and political entities and stuff that God has, pardon me, that God has in view that he will ultimately accomplish. And so in Genesis 15, the first three verses represent, this is the Abrahamic covenant, represents the backbone from which everything else in the new, in the Bible hangs, as it were. This is the core of it, and everything is built to serve that purpose. It isn't just that there's a old way, and now there's a new way, which means the old way is defunct. Broadly, it's just irrelevant, and now we've got some whole new thing, we can toss the old one out. No, the new thing is a fulfillment of the oldest thing, that being the Abrahamic covenant. And even though there are things that are changing in between, and progressive revelation reveals new information, it still is there to serve the original plan. Now, let me tell you part of the reason that I hold this view. It isn't that you can't understand some of the Old Testament better in light of New Testament teaching. I think you can. So there are times. You back with me, Matt? Mark, rather?
Yeah,
sorry. I don't know how much of my explanation you were able to catch there.
No, you're doing good. Great.
Okay. Oh, good. Thank you. It's not that New Testament revelation can't shed light on the Old Testament thing, but the Old Testament is logically prior and foundational to New Testament. So sometimes we're reading the New Testament to make sense out of with the Old Testament. The Book of Hebrews might be a good example of that. But the Book of Hebrews sheds light on it, but it doesn't turn the whole thing topsy turvy. The Old Testament's promises are preeminent, which then are fulfilled in later history, which the New Testament records and explains.
Yeah.
And sometimes we might be a little obscure as to the nature of the promises, but the New Testament helps out. Here is the concern that I have with always reading the Old Testament in light of the New Testament. It gives rise to what I think is a mistaken theology. Whereas in the Old Testament, God makes very particular and specific promises to national Israel, which promises in the context national Israel understood to apply to them, to Abraham and his seeds, that seed, that is, those who would come forth from his own loins. What we can't do is go into the New Testament and then read things about, you know, it is not those who are the children of Abraham that are really Israel, but it is those who have the faith of Abraham that are really Israel, these uncircumcised, the so-called uncircumcised, who are actually circumcised in the heart. This drives a whole theology that replaces Israel with the church, more or less. And
one thing, I don't mean to interrupt there,
but you
kind of hit at the heart of my question right there with that comment, because, of course, in my background, I've kind of held the view that you're describing right now, and
I was describing two views, so which one did you used to hold?
The one you were describing as replacement theology.
Oh, you used to hold the replacement theology view, okay.
No, I currently do, but I don't describe it that way, because, you're hitting right at the verse where you're talking about when Abraham says, and to his seed, God's talking about Abraham's seed.
Yes.
But see, then in Galatians 3, and Paul says very, very specifically,
his seed is Christ.
He says, not to his seed, but to his seed singular, meaning Christ.
Right.
And then, you know, you find language in Hebrews, for example, in Hebrews chapter 11, verse 16, where it talks about how Abraham was looking forward to a heavenly country rather than, you know, more physical one. And again, I'm very open-minded on this and trying to kind of navigate this, so I'm not trying to be dogmatic by any means.
Got it. Okay, and I'm familiar with this whole discussion. Actually, let me encourage you to get a hold of Stand to Reason's product called The Bible Fast Forward. And this is where I kind of stepped through these things more carefully. What we have to do is come up with a theology that makes sense of both of those kinds of statements. Because clearly it sounds like, at least when you read the Hebrews passage just at face value, and even the passage in Galatians, which I'm well aware of, it sounds like that the New Testament is specifically and unequivocally contradicting clear statements of the Hebrew Scriptures. Because in Genesis chapter 12, I think I might have misspoke earlier. Genesis 12, 1 through 3 is the Abrahamic covenant. In Genesis 15, mm-hmm. you have a statement where God promises that his descendants, that is, the descendants of promise in plural, would come forth from his own loins. And in fact, through the rest of the book of Genesis and the rest of the Old Testament, the Jews are called God's people, the seed of Abraham, his descendants, that were part of the covenants of promise. So what we can't do is we can't find a verse in the New Testament that seems to undo all of the obvious sense of the statements in the Old Testament pertaining to this issue, and I think disenfranchises the very people who took God's words to mean them throughout this entire time. So I think there's a solution that can balance them both out. It turns out that the word seed, like Abraham's seed, is used in four different ways. Mm-hmm. It is used by Paul to describe Jesus. But you know as well as I do with biblical words and concepts, sometimes they can be used in multiple ways.
Absolutely.
So the word seed, or the descendants of Abraham, are actually four different kinds. There are the physical descendants of Abraham. There are the spiritual descendants of Abraham, that is, those who have the faith of Abraham that aren't Jews.
Mm-hmm.
Then you have the spiritual physical descendants. The first one is just Jews. The second one are believing Gentiles. The third one are believing Jews. That is, they have the race of Abraham, and they have the faith of Abraham. Those are called the believing remnant. And then the fourth way the term seed is used is of Jesus in Galatians. Each of them have a play in the biblical revelation. And it's interesting when you see that specifically in the Galatian passage where it talks about that the believers now have received the promises of Abraham or the promises of the covenant or whatever, it explicitly identifies the promise of the Spirit. Not the other promises, like of the land and whatever that was made to Abraham, the promise of the Spirit. And that was a provision of the new covenant. And that brings me to Jeremiah 31. And I go into a lot more detail in this other teaching, but I'm just giving you a thumbnail sketch just to give you something to think about, okay?
Sure.
In Jeremiah 31, by the way, the New Testament never calls it the church Israel, just as a matter of record. People assume that it is referring to Israel in sometimes as the new Israel, whatever, but it doesn't. It never calls the church Israel, just as a point of information. Jeremiah 31:31 and following, the new covenant is given there. Okay, that is the contrasted to the Mosaic covenant, which was broken by the Jews. They received the curses as a nation, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
And because there was the nation was before God, and then God says, "Okay, I'm going to give you a new covenant you can't break." And this is the new covenant, and that's where it promised in verse 31. Now, this is the covenant of the Spirit that Jesus then gives when he drinks the wine at the Last Supper, and he announces it, and he initiates it, and he secures it on the cross the next day, and then it's launched in its fullness on Pentecost Sunday. Right.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So now here is what, and that new covenant situation is supposedly when the big switch takes place, or at least when it becomes clear that God always intended his promises to be for the group which is called the church now, and not for national Israel. Now, so here the wording is real important in Jeremiah 31. So I'm reading from 35 now here, after four verses of giving the new covenant. 31, 31 through 34 is the details of the new covenant which Jesus initiated. 35, thus says the Lord, who gives the sun for light by day, and the fixed order of the moon and the stars for light by night, who stirs up the sea so that its waves roar, the Lord of hosts is his name. If this fixed order departs from me. Now, that's the fixed order he's just referred to, giving the sun for light by day, the moon, the fixed order of the moon and stars for night. If this fixed order departs from me, declares the Lord, then the offspring of Israel shall also cease from being a nation before me forever. If the heavens above can be measured and the foundations of earth searched out below. Now, these are hyperbole to the negative. He says this could never happen. Then I will also cast off the offspring of Israel from for all that they have done, declares the Lord. Now, clearly the offspring of Israel here, especially qualified by the phrase for all that they have done, is national Israel. It can't be anybody else. But God, just after he gives the new covenant, at a time when the Jews are now in Babylon, remember this is the prophet of Jeremiah writing to Babylon, where the Jews are in captivity, is
right.
saying that a new covenant is coming, and the new covenant does not exclude them as being a nation in its unique sense before God. To me, this is one of the most powerful passages that makes it clear that any kind of replacement theology is simply mistaken.
And for you, and I'm listening very carefully to this, so mm-hmm. so one way you might respond then, if I said that national Israel is fulfilled in Christ himself, you're going to go back to this passage and say, well, here we have an explicit statement to the contrary.
Yeah, it couldn't be fulfilled in that sense, because that means these people would be left out in the cold, and that's exactly what God says is not going to take place. So however we understand the role of Christ, we have to understand, and being the seed, as Galatians describes, we have to understand him in a way that keeps this promise intact. Because if we don't, we're in big trouble. Because then I could say, well, what in the New Testament looks really clear as a promise to me, as clear as this did to them, and then all of a sudden we find out that God's, you know, he's it's a bait and switch.
Right. You know, and so, if you know, one question that was coming to my mind until you got to that text would be, could this not be a heavenly or even on the new earth kind of fulfillment? And your point is, with the text describing the fact that none of this will pass away before this happens, is a clincher that it happens here and now.
Well, it's not only that, but virtually all the promises of the kingdom given with almost all the prophets describe an earthly kingdom. I mean, there are so many of them. I mean, every prophet speaks of this, an earthly
yeah.
kingdom that will be granted to Israel. And so somewhere down the line, that kingdom has to be manifest. Or if we, in a sense, kind of spiritualize all of these promises that Israel didn't seem to think were being spiritualized, what are we supposed to make of other promises in the New Testament? And keep in mind, this hermeneutical principle that I'm applying now is that you have to make sense of the teaching in light of the people the teaching is being given to.
Agreed.
Yeah, so anyway, I could be wrong on this, and I know this is a contentious issue between, I guess, the covenant guys and the amillennialists and the premillennialists and whatever. But,
sure.
But I have to find a way to do my New Testament theology that keeps acknowledges or secures the integrity of these promises that we see that God.
Well, that explanation really helps me, because again, you know, I'm not seeking full agreement on all topics,
sure.
but as you kind of representing the role of a teacher of some, you know, of great material that I've really enjoyed over the years
mm-hmm.
and really have learned from. This was just one I was kind of like, I need to know what Greg's really thinking here.
Mm-hmm.
So that I can at least understand, even if I don't choose to agree, can really see where you're coming from, and then I can learn from that at the very
yeah,
minimum.
I appreciate that. I go back to Genesis 15, where notice it's interesting that Abraham doesn't have any children, but he's been given this promise of a great nation, right? And so according to the custom of his time, his wealth and, you know, his estate, as it were, would fall to the leader of his household. And that man was named Eliezer. He's from Damascus. I mean, we have it right there in the text. And so Abraham is saying, hey, I'm an old man, and you made this promise that I would have this great nation. Well, maybe this will fall to Eliezer of Damascus. So if one were to, in a sense, spiritualize the promises, it could easily go to him. Because there doesn't need to be a genetic connection between the people God promised if it was this other kind of promise. But here's what God says. He says, no, but those children of promise shall come forth from your own loins. And in fact, it's not just any child. It is then narrowed from Abraham to Isaac, not Esau, and then to Jacob, not or did I get him wrong? Ishmael. To
sure.
Isaac, not Ishmael, then Jacob, not Esau. So notice how the narrowing of the children of promise is based on, physical descendants.
Yeah.
So yeah. Abraham, Isaac, all and Jacob, then the 12 sons. Yeah, so
yeah, all the way down to Christ.
Right, and these, and notice the physical lineage. Now, I think Jesus is the promise. The new covenant is the promise of chapter 12, verse 3 in Genesis, of that so you shall be a blessing to all the goyim, all the Gentile nations. And that the blessing of the Abrahamic covenant is the new covenant in the person of Jesus. And so he is the seed that makes that whole thing work.
Yeah.
The most important part of the covenant, which is the salvation thing. But God is not just going to rescue us spiritually through forgiveness. He is also going to rescue us politically. And I think that's part of the redemption of the world in restoration, after which that's the kingdom on earth, and then after which there'll be a new heavens and new earth. Anyway, try to get a hold of that, the Bible Fast Forward, and I go into a lot more detail that, and you can draw your own conclusions. Okay, Mark?
That sounds great, Greg. Appreciate your time and your answers.
You're welcome. It's a good call. Let's quickly go to Marietta and Todd. Can we do this? Yeah. We have to go to break? Let's just keep going because I talk too much to Mark. All right, Todd, welcome to the show.
Thanks a lot. That last discussion was real good because I was just got done reading Hank Hanegraaff's book and kind of went in a little opposite opinion in that one.
Yeah, I respect him. I actually haven't read that book, but I know that he's arguing the other way. But I think these are points that have to be dealt with.
Sure. Hey, I'm probably one of your greatest fans. I'm in janitorial business, so I work most of the night, and I probably get about 10 hours or better of podcasting of you per week.
Wow. How is that, since I only podcast 3 hours a week?
Because I re-listen and re-listen.
Okay. Right. Oh, that's my favorite kind of fan. All right, great.
Yeah, but then I get out on my bicycle, and I ride anywhere from, 3 to 5 hours, about 3 days, 4 days a week.
Oh, so you get good for you. By the way, you're in Marietta. I'm going to be out there sometime in the fall at a big conference at the Veritas College, just so you know.
Oh, yeah, that's over at the Calvary Bible College.
Right, that's right. Uh-huh.
Okay, yeah, I'd like to go to that. I've heard a lot of neat things about them.
So what's on your mind?
Well, hey, when I get on these long rides, I get in this park. I don't want to talk about bicycle racing and stuff all the time, so I get on with these guys. I bring in and different topics I listen to during the week, and I started talking to a friend of mine about the problem of evil and the nature of it, and where did it come from, and its origins, and then relativism, truth, design.
Right.
And so it just kind of blows people's minds, but when I'm on a one-on-one, I can do that.
Uh-huh.
And I was talking with a person the other day, and we're talking about relativism a little bit, and I kind of went into like homosexuality.
Uh-huh.
And I said, there's a person that once said, it says, gosh, I was born this way. And I said, no, you were born a man with certain design features.
Right.
Like you look a woman. You don't, there's certain things you can choose in life, certain things you can't choose.
Yeah, look in the mirror is what I tell people, and you can see what kind of sex that nature gave you a body for. Nature or God, however you want to cast it. Your body is made for the opposite sex, not for the same sex. So at very best, they might have a kind of a split sexual personality. The body says one thing, and maybe their intentions or mind or something says something else.
Yeah, it just kind of led in, and I said, just because you have a propensity to act in a different way than you were designed doesn't make it right. And I said, just as a person might say, oh, I was born a pedophile, or I was born to have sex with animals, or whatever sexual deviation they might want to come up with. And he told me, no, that is different. Homosexuality is different because from these other deviations, because it's between two consenting people with full understanding.
Uh-huh.
For example, a child doesn't have understanding. An animal can't act back differently or consent.
Yeah.
I felt like that was a straw man, and I just didn't know how to break it down.
Okay, well, first of all, very quickly here, because I'm mindful of time, but first of all, your response was on point. Their response to you wasn't. They subtly changed topics. Now, I'm not saying they're being devious, but this just happens in conversations. Notice how they first started arguing. It's natural. Therefore, it's okay. They were born this way, and therefore it's okay. So your response was to that point, and your response was essentially, just because someone is born with a certain propensity doesn't make it right. And you gave some examples. Then they switched tracks on you and said, no, in our case it's okay because we have consenting adults. Well, that has nothing to do with how you're born. Now you're advancing a different argument. You're saying the actions are okay because they're consenting adults, not because they were born that way. And so the response to that is, first of all, let me ask you, do you see the difference there? Do you see a shift? Pardon me?
Yeah, I see where he's shifting it, but he brings in the arguments different because the other people are doing it without knowledge. When someone takes advantage of a young child in that respect, as a pedophile, it's wrong because the child isn't able to have knowledge. Of course, then what age does the child have knowledge? I don't know.
Right, but I just wanted to point out that he shifted gears. That he said, first of all, you were arguing that it's okay because they were born that way. Now, regardless of whether or not they were born that way, and frankly, right now, the evidence does not bear that out, but being born that way can't be a justification for this reason. So before we go to the consenting adult business, do you agree that being born that way is not a good enough justification? Because then you'd have to say that being born a pedophile would justify the pedophilia impulse, but it might be disqualified for another reason, which is what they're bringing up. By the way, I don't understand how he can argue against bestiality, frankly. If a person was born with that kind of desire, he's saying, well, animals can't make decisions. Well, so what? We use animals for beasts of burden. We eat them, for goodness sake. We kill them. If that's all legitimate, why can't we have sex with them on his thinking? So that doesn't make sense to me. But the question they're saying is simply okay because they're consenting adults. And I guess my response would be he might be able to use that to disqualify certain parallels, you know, like children can't give meaningful consent. All right, fair enough. I don't think that's what makes homosexuality wrong. Homosexuality is wrong whether you have consenting adults or not. Consent doesn't make a wrong thing right.
Mm-hmm.
He's trying to argue that, well, we have consenting adults, so it makes it right. Well, how does that – if I consented to you killing me, go ahead, shoot me, would that make it okay to consenting adults? Now, the problem here, of course, is that I think it's difficult for people who are deeply socialized by our culture regarding homosexuality – thinking that it's just fine, it's just wonderful. I mean, I get these home remodeling magazines, and it'd be amazing how often they have such and so and his partner
have
remodeled this house. I mean, it's everywhere. It's in TV. There's a concerted effort to make this seem normal. By the way, this is in This Old House magazine. By the way, you know, you'd think this is a conservative thing, a bunch of, you know, hardcore, you know, guys swinging hammers and pickaxes and plumbing and all that kind of stuff and carpentry. I don't know about the principals in there, but the editors or whatever, they got to put this stuff in there because they're trying to promote it. So when you have a culture that's deeply influenced by that kind of socialization, there's hardly any way you're going to argue with somebody to get him to see that homosexuality is wrong if he's already convinced that it's just fine.
Yeah, I can't use I try not to use the Bible to make my case,
because
that already throws a red flag up.
Yeah.
So I'm going to grant him that there's a consenting adult. I'm not going to argue why that's wrong, mm-hmm. per se, but I want to say what's the difference, or that is it a difference without a distinction or with a distinction when it comes to being a pedophile or any other deviation?
Well, I don't use that illustration because people think, they say, well, you're making homosexuals out to be as bad as pedophiles. And, of course, they don't buy that notion, and they think that you're kind of tipping the scales in your favor by using this exaggerated example, and that just turns them off. And I'll be honest with you, I don't know any fancy way to convince people that homosexuality is wrong when they've been so deeply socialized the other way. Apart from just the if it's not obvious to somebody to begin with, you know, if it's not obvious to them, I just usually don't even go down that road because it creates an obstacle that is difficult to overcome when I want to talk to them about other issues. I found that with certain moral issues, people figure it, especially sexual ones, people figure it out after Christ comes into their life and not before, unless the individual is under conviction himself. And I think, ironically, and this is a bit speculative here, but ironically, I think it's sometimes easier to convince a homosexual that homosexuality is wrong because he's doing the wrong thing and he's bearing the burden in violence to his own soul and conscience about it than it is to somebody who is not a homosexual and has just been socialized to believe that it's fine, though it's not their cup of tea.
No, I wasn't trying to make the argument why homosexuality was wrong, but he kept mentioning that why it's wrong to be a pedophile or any other deviation is,
so
again,
he,
because I...
Okay, so maybe you can ask him this. You say, are you telling me that the only thing wrong with pedophilia is you don't have a consenting adult? That if you could have like a really precocious child who seemed quite mature and capable of making decisions for himself, that if he said, yeah, this is fine with me, then it would be okay?
Good point.
I mean, that's kind of the way he's arguing.
Well, so, I'll look into that. I know you kind of get it going. Hey, I thank you for your deity of Christ case closed. I had a couple Mormons jump in my garage on me yesterday while I was working on my Jeep, and I went back to the two last sessions I think you had with, I believe it was
right,
Jeff,
with someone else, right, on that issue, right.
Yeah, and I immediately jumped into that. They would not answer the question. They kept saying, I'm trying to bait and trap them. I said, you know, who is Christ?
Oh, gosh.
Is he created or is he uncreated? I mean, that's all I want to know.
Yeah, well, it is a trap in a certain sense, but it is an utterly legitimate trap given the nature of the issue. You're trying to show them that there's unequivocal evidence in the New Testament, which they say they believe in, that Jesus is the uncreated creator. Listen, I got to run here, Todd. Thanks
Great.
So much for the call. I'm going to run off to Chris in Ohio for the last 2 minutes here. Chris, welcome to the show. Sorry we got such a short time.
That's cool. Did you read any good things on the plane lately?
Did I read any good things on the plane? I'm actually just finishing up Anthony Flew's book, There Is a God, and I'm enjoying that.
Okay, never mind. My question is, what do you do with the charge that nothing of a spiritual nature is logical? And I'm not saying that coming from someone who doesn't agree with Christianity, but actually a Christian who's kind of the anti-intellectual candidate.
My question is, why would you ever say that? That's what I would say to them. I'd ask them that question. Why would you say that?
Well, I know the rejoinder might be that the natural man doesn't receive spiritual things of God, and the use of logic or rationale is a natural thing that we do with our minds, but we should be trying to perceive things,
okay,
quote-unquote, in
okay,
the spirit.
Okay, I understand the argument. It comes out of 1 Corinthians 2 or 3. But if that take on that passage in 1 Corinthians is correct, then why did the apostles and Jesus himself and the prophets all use logic? They gave arguments. They gave evidence. They sought to persuade. In fact, Acts 18 uses those very words. Paul says, as was his custom, or Luke writes, as was Paul's custom, he reasoned with them from the scriptures, and some were persuaded. It says in Acts chapter 1 that many infallible proofs. By the way, for the person saying that you can't prove Christianity, why is it that Luke in Acts chapter 1 uses that very language? I'm turning to it right now. By many infallible, where is this? Here it is, verse 3. To these he also presented himself alive after his suffering by many convincing proofs, appearing to them over a period of 40 days. Speaking of the things concerning the kingdom of God. This is Jesus' post-resurrection appearances. So for the purpose, for the person who wants to camp on 1 Corinthians 2 or 3 there and say what this means is that we cannot use logic and reason, whatever, then they're going to have a very hard time explaining virtually every single witnessing occasion in the book of Acts, for example. Because they, in every single case, they give evidences. Here is Acts. I'm looking at Acts chapter 10, where you have Peter speaking to Cornelius, and he says, "Jesus of Nazareth. He went around doing good, healing, and all are oppressed by the devil. God was with him. There's evidences. 39. We are witnesses of all the things he did.
Right.
Verse 40, God raised him up on the third day, granting that he should become visible, not to everybody, but to us. And then he told us to preach the gospel and to solemnly testify that he is the one who has been appointed. Verse 43, of him all the prophets bear witness. Do you see all the evidences right there in chapter 10 of Acts? So God bless your friend who is, you know, your pietistic anti-intellectual friend who's camping on 1 Corinthians, but they're misusing that passage. What that passage says is that they're spiritually appraised. Not that they can't be understood. And by the way, that's the things of God are spiritually appraised. So all the teachings of New Testament doctrine are not for non-Christians, they're for Christians. And so, I mean, they're written to us who spiritually appraise them. People who don't have the Spirit, that doesn't make any sense to them. It doesn't mean they can't be reasoned with, though, on other things. In fact, a person could even come to the right interpretation of a passage based on the words in the passage, but the passage just won't have the significance to them because the Spirit isn't working in their hearts to see that. I think that's what's going on in Corinthians.
Okay.
Does that make sense to you, Chris?
It does, thanks.
You know, I'll tell you a very quick little thing because I got about 60 seconds here. We got in trouble with Google because we were promoting articles against homosexuality on Google. And basically one of them was that I was showing what the Bible taught about it, that's all. And particularly, say, in Sodom and Gomorrah. And I got interviewed by a non-Christian person who actually read my articles and said, I think you're right in that the Bible teaches against homosexuality. But she didn't agree that with the Bible. So there she got it. She was able to get the point, but she didn't appraise it properly because she doesn't have the Spirit. So I think that's what's going on there. The disciples all used logic and arguments and reasoning, and so did Jesus, and so did the prophets. The Bible is thick with it. Therefore, that couldn't be what the Corinthians passage is meaning. Thanks so much for your call, Chris. And to the rest of you, I appreciate you joining me today. Look forward to our next time together. Your homework this week at SDR.org is the Christian story. Find it there right on the homepage. Religions are like puzzles, and Christianity is one. Here's how it all fits together. I tell you there. All right, friends, talk to you next time. I'm Greg Kokel for Stand to Reason. You go out and give them heaven this week. Bye-bye now.